welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. We've got a large crew here with me today. I'm Brian Vitale. Joining me, we've got the usuals. We've got Josh Torres.
Salutations.
Mikhail Mednani.
Hello.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
Chow Min Wu.
How's it going?
And returning to join us on the TetraCast this week, special welcome to Hayes Madsen.
Hello, hello.
Good to have you back, Hayes. And the coverage of this episode, we know it's a very busy time of the year for game releases, especially for RPGs. We've kind of had the back half of October circled for forever in terms of game releases. And the reason why we have Hayes with us this week is to help us cover one of those games. So we've had a lot of releases in the last couple of weeks, and we've got a lot of things embargoed that we're still working on as a site. As a main topic for this week's episode of the TetraCast, we're going to be talking about The Outer Worlds 2, which releases next week, but the embargo is up, so we are able to talk about it. Now, our coverage up on our site, Junior Mii was able to cover The Outer Worlds 2 for us, but was not able to make it on this episode of the TetraCast. We've had Hayes on the podcast before. Hayes primarily writes over at Inverse, and he also was able to cover The Outer Worlds 2. So we were able to get him on this podcast to help us lead the discussion on that game. And then we'll also talk about a few other releases. Fantasy Maiden Wars will be our second topic for this episode. And then we'll go into the news of the week. So that'll be the rundown. So that sound good to everyone?
I'll just note that The Outer Worlds 2 actually, like, it's in that early release period right now.
Oh, where right. It's in that privilege to pay early.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite early, yeah.
Weird game to do that with.
Yeah. We'll go into that context a little bit. So we're going to give the microphone, proverbially, over to Hayes. So none of the other regular cast on this podcast have been able to put significant time into The Outer Worlds 2 yet, because our early code went to Junior and we have not had access to play it yet. I think Mikhail was able to go a little bit on that, but we will be able to bounce off what Hayes was able to, you know, his reception to the game, his review, compare it with Junior's thoughts, our thoughts with the first game, and, you know, other Obsidian and Microsoft products, things like that. So we'll just have a back and forth about that release. And without further ado, just, you know, take it away, Hayes. You know, your time with Outer Worlds 2, you're writing for it for Inverse, your thoughts, and we'll just go from there.
Yeah, I guess easiest way is kind of like top-level thoughts. You know, in some ways, it kind of feels like Avowed to a degree, where Avowed kind of took the formula of Pillars of Eternity, you know, and blew it up a little more. This is a little more of a straight sequel, but it still is like kind of taking that formula of the first Outer Worlds and blowing it up to a larger degree. And I mean that on, like, multiple levels. So, like, you have the skill system that was in the first one, but this game takes that to the extreme, where, like, the skills are really important to the core experience, and kind of dictate how you navigate through quests and how you interact with factions, and unlocks a bunch of different things based on however you want to specialize. I actually compare it a lot to, you know, Obsidian's kind of history in CRPGs, where, you know, CRPGs like Pillars of Eternity or Baldur's Gate, the huge emphasis on player choice and kind of the character build that you have and what you specialize in, and whether it's lore craft or speech or whatever that might be. And this kind of takes that idea and fuses it with the first-person RPG trappings of, like, the first Outer Worlds or Fallout. I think Fallout's a good example, actually, because the game that I would say that inspires this the most is Fallout New Vegas, in terms of kind of how you interact with the world, and especially the emphasis on factions. I know the first Outer Worlds had factions, but this, factions are, like, the core part of the experience. It's main narrative, the decisions you make on how that narrative plays out, it affects the quests, it affects your playstyle, it affects your companions, it's everything. And it also kind of represents that, you know, the satirical tone that the first Outer Worlds had in kind of critiquing capitalism, rampant capitalism and authoritarianism. And that's another aspect that I think this sequel, like, really dials up to 11. And it's interesting because first, like, 3 to 4 hours that I played this game, I wasn't sure if I liked that aspect. I think a common criticism you hear of the first Outer Worlds is that the humor was too on the nose. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I get that that's something that people felt. And this is so much more on the nose, it's not even funny. And at first I thought it was going a little too hard. But I think this game in particular is very fascinating in the fact that everything starts to click more the more you get into it. Like, after the 4 to 5 hour point, writing really started working for me. I think the factions started feeling a little more complex than just that on-the-nose commentary. The skill system started clicking together more. You unlock extra weapons, more complex weapons, more mods. And it really is just an experience of, like, everything starts to click together the further that you get.
I don't mean to cut you off, but, like, I've just got, like, very, like, top level questions, and I'm sure that, like, yeah. I guess a lot of people.
I was actually wrapping up, so yeah.
Yeah. But, like, first, for people going into this game, I know a lot of people might have, you know, will they need to have played the Outer Worlds 1? Like, will it enhance their experience of the Outer Worlds 2 if they play the first one first? And kind of as a lead up or a follow up to the building off of that. Like, I know a lot of people, just from the outset, the first Outer Worlds was a very divisive game in terms of, like, mm-hmm. as a smaller scope project. It was definitely, you could feel, like, you know, its budget limitations on that game based on, like, what people's expectations are of an Obsidian game. So it's very much more contained, more linear, smaller scope than I'm sure a lot of people are hoping. Does the Outer Worlds 2, like, live up to that expectation that people initially had of the Outer Worlds 1 being an Obsidian title?
Yeah, so it's interesting that Outer Worlds 2 is definitely bigger than Outer Worlds 1, but it's still not, like, not a Bethesda RPG, right? Like, it still has that very constrained, focused scope, even though it is larger ostensibly than the first game. But I actually talked about this on another podcast that, like, it's hard to answer, because I think if you've played the first Outer Worlds, what you get out of this game is going to depend on what you liked about the first Outer Worlds or what you didn't like. So, like, if you loved the writing and you loved the setting and you thought, I wish the combat was just a little better or a little less messy, like, that's something that you might like in this. But if you did not like the humor and you did not like the tone of the first game, you probably also will not like the second game, because it really just kind of, like, takes those elements of the first game and kind of ramps them up even more.
Okay. I'm curious about, like, one thing. Well, actually, a couple of things, but I'll...
Let Brian, because Brian raised his hand, like, on the voice chat.
I wasn't cutting in, because I was just happy just listening. Okay. I just a few comments kind of floating around in my head. Let me see if I can string them together. Because, yeah, some of the context is that the first Outer Worlds was primarily developed when Obsidian was independent, and it was published by Private Division, and then released shortly after their acquisition by Microsoft. At the time, that's why it was multi-platform, that's why it had a smaller scope, things like that. And now a lot has changed in 6 years, and we'll go into that in more detail later. And then in addition, you talked about Avowed was kind of interesting because it had a lot of the trappings of, like, the prototypical Obsidian RPG, but it was also a lot more arcadey in terms of, like, the way the worlds were set up, the way that the gear and, like, progression worked. And I'm not saying that was a bad idea. It just felt different, like they were trying something different. So with Outer Worlds 2, it does kind of feel like complementary, at least the way you're describing it in that way, where it has a, you know, when Outer Worlds 1 was first shown off, people were saying, like, oh my God, this looks like Fallout. Fallout's back. It's really not a lot like Fallout. It doesn't have the same, like, world design. It doesn't have the same, like, open structure. I always described it as more like Mass Effect, not in terms of theme, but in terms of, like, gameplay, going moment to moment, how quests work, how the hubs work, and things like that. The only thing it really had similar to Fallout, the first game, was the retro future aspect. The fact that it was kind of like, how we envision the future from the perspective of someone in the mid-1900s. It kind of had that like gear punk, steampunky future. I don't know all those terms, like where you draw all those lines. And it's cool that I'm glad to hear you say that they didn't shy away from the tone aspect of it, because they so easily could have, because it's hard to write comedy that appeals super broadly, especially yes. when you're under a giant publisher like Microsoft and your goal is to sell 20 billion copies or whatever. Like, no, they have a focus, they have a tone that they're going to try to hit, and it won't be for everyone. And as someone who didn't really like the tone of the first game, like I didn't dislike it, but it was kind of in the middle. I'm glad that they didn't change their approach for my sake. You know, I'd rather they write what they want to write. So that's kind of like, I'm glad to hear that you describe it that way.
Also, one last thing, Hayes mentioned that it reminded him of Fallout New Vegas. And that was kind of, I had the chance to interview Brandon Adler, who is the director of this game, who did not work on the original, by the way. A lot of the team is the same between the two games, but the director is new. But he did work on Fallout New Vegas, and things like factions, that was specifically, I know he just said it's not quite Fallout, but the faction component specifically was like the one thing that he felt he liked in New Vegas and was something that could be improved in this entry, especially with the companions and like how that, you know, the multiple perspectives come together here.
Yeah, there's actually a few developers on this worked on New Vegas. Mm-hmm. Or other Fallout games. Like, one is Leonard Boyarsky is the creative director on this, and while he didn't work on New Vegas, he actually was one of the original designers and art directors on the first two Fallout games.
Yeah.
I was curious about a couple of things, because I did play the original Outer Worlds, and I thought it was okay. I did have some issues with the writing. It wasn't necessarily with the tone, but rather, like, there was some weird elements when it came to, like, The thing I'm specifically thinking about is the dynamics between the cannery like city and the like farm.
Yeah,
and how that resolved. It's like that always kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
I know where you're going with this, and interestingly, I actually just talked to a friend about this exact thing yesterday. With like that quest, how I don't know if you felt the same way. One of the problems I had with that quest is that like, the people outside the cannery, if you give like the electricity to them, that's almost treated like a wrong choice, right?
Yeah.
I think when I was talking to my friend about this yesterday, there actually is, in the first world, there's a very similar quest where you have to try and talk to these two settlements and figure out what to do with them and who you're going to support and who's going to, if you sabotage someone. And there actually is an option where, like, this protectorate settlement, which is, like, the authoritarian regime, you can sabotage them and get them to leave, but then they are able to just, like, migrate and settle with this other faction. So, I haven't seen all the elements of how that quest can end, but it does feel like there has been at least a bit of thought on kind of like moral quandary that the first Outer Worlds sometimes had, where despite the fact that you're not supposed to have like a certain faction that's the good guys or the bad guys, sometimes in the first game there were outcomes that very much felt that way. And I think this game is generally, not all the time, but generally much better about kind of giving you that, hey, yeah, everyone really kind of sucks.
Feeling. Okay, yeah, that was one thing. The other issue I have, the first game wasn't really narrative so much as a gameplay thing. That being that it felt like to me when I did my playthrough, like by the end of the game, it didn't feel like I was specializing in anything, because it felt like I could just do everything with like no real drawbacks. Mm-hmm. Is that the same here, or like how did it feel on your end?
For skills, very much not like that, because I quickly found out that you really should specialize in a couple skills, because they designed this game in a way that if you're kind of trying to do everything, you're not going to be able to do a lot of the more interesting quest options. So, like, for example, if you want to get your talk your way out of everything, you really need to specialize in that speech skill. You might get this game constantly does skill checks on you. But it has, most quests have multiple different skill checks, so that if you've specialized in one thing or specialized in two things, you'll see that option pop up here and there. And there's also the perk system, which lets you, you know, you have a bunch of different perks you can choose from, and I feel like those are more intricately woven into the game. Like, one of the... I chose the gambler background to start with, and with that I chose a perk that's the luck perk. And I like, at least a dozen times throughout my playthrough, the luck perk would just pop up randomly, where, like, I'm trying to hack this computer, and it's like, oh, you could just hit the keys randomly because you have the luck perk. Or, like, there's this equation that needs to be solved, and it's like, oh, just guess the number and you get it. So there's a lot of different ways that you can support this. And the skill system and the perk system, and also the flaw system, which is a whole different thing, but if we want to talk about that separately.
Yeah, before we get into that, I guess the first thing I want to mention, too, is, since we're on the topic of speccing into skills and specializations and stuff, one of the main talking points about this game leading up to its release is, I remember our RPG site's boss, Alex Donaldson, he also wrote a review about on this game at Eurogamer. And one of the things that he's been talking about in this game is, when he had an interview with Obsidian several months back, they specifically mentioned, hey, we're not going to let you do any respeccing in this game. We really want people to roleplay as their character. They feel like offering that respec option takes a bit of that roleplay out of the role-playing game category, so to speak. And they want people to commit to, you know, finding a build that they want to do. And I know a lot of people... especially like, you know, a lot of the modern audience is like, I don't know if I really want to get into this game because they're not offering respec. I'm sure there'll be mods that'll offer it unofficially on PC, but it's just, what would you say about that experience of, like, hey, knowing that there's no respeccing in this game? As far as I know, I don't know if they actually offer it in the game after all.
I don't think there is. I haven't explicitly, like, looked for a way, but I don't think there is a way. Me personally, when I play RPGs like this, I don't typically respec, because my experience, I do kind of like to commit and see the consequences of that, right? And I get that might be an issue for some people, but I think the more restrained scale of this as an RPG, where, like, Critical Path you can get through in 20 to 30 hours, or you can beat the whole thing in, like, 60 hours, and that's still a lot of time. I know that it's still a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
But it's easier to digest that, I think, than in a game like Skyrim, right? Where, like, this is a 200-hour game, and if I can't respec, then I'm never going to do this again. And I think there's a little more wiggle room for something like that in a more constrained RPG like this.
I believe that it allows you to respec in the... Mikhail might be saying the same thing. I think it allows you to respec in, like, the starting zone.
Oh yes.
Yeah, when you finish the prologue mission. And they, like, obviously not getting into spoilers, but when you finish and you wake up in your ship, you get an option over there saying, do you want to respec or not? And that's the only time you can do it, as far as I can tell.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay. And I guess before we move forward, it is especially important to acknowledge it's not just Outer Worlds 2, it's also with the release of Ninja Gaiden 4, with the release of Keeper. From Double Fine. And of course, with the newly announced Halo campaign evolved remake for Xbox Series, PC, and PlayStation 5, you know, all of these games are published by Microsoft. They are sometimes internally developed by Microsoft in Halo's case. And it's important to mention that, hey, Microsoft was put on the boycott, divest, and sanction list several months ago in response to them sharing, lending their tech to the Israel's ongoing genocide on Palestinians over there. And I, of course, we're not saying, like, hey, you should feel bad for, like, you know, playing these games or whatnot. But hey, it's, if you wanna, you know, do your part in, like, the boycott movement, in this case, you know, just, it's kind of like we exist in a weird paradoxical relationship where, obviously, we don't want to support genocide. I think we can all agree on that. But, you know, as but we also are covering games as part of our jobs, as, you know, journalists on, like, the newest releases of these games. And it is up for everyone personally to decide, like, you know, whether to, you know, abide by the BDS movement or not. Like, personally, that I can only speak for me that, like, I follow that movement. So I personally, you know, don't play these games until Microsoft is off of that. I won't, you know, talk about them publicly, and I won't, you know, try to sell it to people. And that's just a personal choice on my end. I know everyone's situation is different, and I just want to be obviously transparent and honest up front and acknowledging that that is the reality that we live in. You know, we can't change the reality that we live in. That's just the current circumstance.
When I asked Junior, our reviewer, if he wanted to cover this game, the very first thing he said is, I want to, you know, acknowledge the BDS movement and Microsoft's, you know, role in this. Is that okay? And of course, my answer is, actually, I'd be disappointed if you didn't talk about it at all. Like, I do think bringing that awareness in the review is a perfectly appropriate and acceptable place to put it. So he reviewed the game and he talked about, you know, everything about the game that he, you know, liked or liked more or liked less. But he definitely wanted to include that awareness of, you know, because not everyone is aware of these things, like of what, you know, these movements and everyone's roles in these games. I saw some people who thought that this game was still published by Private Division. They didn't even realize it was a Microsoft game now, even though Obsidian's been with Microsoft for like 5 or 6 years. So that was kind of the intent, was awareness so that people reading can make those decisions with that context.
Yeah,
and you landed similarly, Hayes, in your review as well, and acknowledging that odd paradoxical relationship, not only with just, you know, covering it, but also within the context of the game itself, where, you know, the very things it critiques is also living under that regime.
What's that one quote from Disco Elysium? Capitalism can,
I'm sure I'll remember it as soon as I hear it, but Hayes, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on all that context.
Definitely, yeah. You know, in terms of like covering these things, I can't get too much into my situation because I, you know, at Inverse, I am part of corporate media, and all I can say is we've had a lot of talks on how and if we're going to cover Xbox games, but I knew, you know, I love Obsidian games, and I, for my whole life, and I knew that with the small team that we have, if Outer Worlds 2 was going to be covered, it would likely be covered by me. And I knew going in that I didn't think I could talk about this game without talking about the state of Microsoft or what they're doing in some way. And even outside of the BDS stuff, I think in the context of this game, which is, you know, like the first game, a pretty scathing satire on capitalism and the state of capitalism and oligarchy and things like that, I think it's impossible to talk about this game without talking about also the Xbox stuff of, you know, the and over 10,000 employees that Microsoft has laid off in the last few years, or the AI infrastructure that they've invested in that has resulted in some of those layoffs, or the studios that have been shut down, like Tango and Arcane Lyon, and all these different things. When you see a game that does things like this, and Outer Worlds 2 is very much informed by the moment. Like, there's a quest that you do where you do it for Auntie's Choice, which is like the big capitalist faction, right? And if you're trying to curry favor with them, you get a quest where you have to go to a planet and break up a workers' strike to try and get curry favor so you can get them to do what you want. There is a funny bit, actually, where all of the executives, like, don't know the word strike. And so every time so you're like, oh, they're striking. And the executives are like, striking? You mean they're going to hit me? And it's just like a recurring bit where every executive is incompetent and just doesn't even know what the word strike means. But you go to and the strike is very clearly inspired by certain events that happened with Amazon, where delivery drivers were leaving themselves in bottles. That same thing happens in the Outer Worlds too. And so you have to do this whole quest of where you're negotiating workers and executives, and like it's a very complicated quest in terms of like how you approach it. And they do give you the option of if you want to be like the person who's advocating for workers' rights, or if you want to be the scummy executive who's like, I don't care, I just need my money. But in the context of like a quest like that, that is so clearly of the exact moment, I don't think you can talk about this game without talking about the context of where and how it was made. And insofar as like, I genuinely think you're doing a disservice of trying to get people to understand the kind of game this is, what it's trying to talk about, what it's trying to do without that context. I genuinely think it's important to just on a basic level, kind of digging into what the Outer Worlds 2 wants to be as a piece of entertainment or a piece of art.
Yeah, I see what you mean. It's a really tricky situation. Go for it.
It's like when it's directly in like literally the almost the fabric of the game in terms of everything about the Outer Worlds has to do with like a satire on capitalism and business executives and corporate morality. It naturally should come up that you talk about the game itself and how it was made. It feels like if you were to try to avoid it, it's almost like you're sabotaging yourself or you're handicapping yourself.
Like, it's almost guaranteed that like a bunch of the people that worked on Outer Worlds 2 have had these same exact thoughts about like, this is absolutely the type of game we're making. And it's like, yeah, it's like, even just from the standpoint of you should mention it because the people making this game absolutely understood that connection.
Mm-hmm. You don't make like this under the publisher that you have and not know the connection, right? Like, it's not possible.
Go for it,
Brian. Sometimes you hear like, well, I don't, you know, I, it almost sounds silly to say, but people will have the response like, well, I want to play this game and not think about those things. Or this is just fiction, guys. It's not really, but it's like, well, if I'm a writer at a studio and I'm taking pen to paper or, you know, keyboard to OneNote file or whatever it is, and I'm trying to like create these scenarios, write up these quests, design this game, you're going to draw from those real life experiences. And when was this game made? It was developed over the last 6 years, from 2019 to 2025. So it doesn't take a lot of a leap of logic to kind of see the context in which the game was developed, what implicitly or explicitly inspired, you know, those writing choices, the environment in which the game was made, in which these characters, we'll talk, I suppose, about the companions and such, because I know those were a pretty highlight of your review. And then just to preempt one final thing, we've never said this, and I think it's obvious, but just to make it as clear as possible, like, even with all of this factored in, and with all of us making our individual decisions whether to support the game or not, like, that is not our decision as a podcast to leverage onto anyone. Like, we're still clearly here talking about the Outer Worlds 2 as our headlining topic of this week's episode of the podcast. Like, we're not, there is no decision there in terms of like, you should or should not play this game. Like, we are not dictating any of that. And I know that sounds obvious. Well, of course you're not. Like, but
yeah, at the end of the day, we're just informing people of like, hey, here's what you had expect how to play this game.
Giving the context around it. Yeah.
You're right. Yeah. But yeah, circling back around, your impressions on Outer Worlds 2, Hayes, like you mentioned something about a flaw system in the game, and two, like when you mentioned it's generally a bigger game, like first, let's talk about the flaws, and second, like what are people signing up for in terms of like just how explorable is it all around compared to like the first game?
Yeah, I'm curious what your favorite flaw is.
Yeah, I actually do have one. So flaw system is actually one of the more interesting parts of the game, because it's this new idea where, like, the actions that you take in the game kind of, the game responds to
the first
and
one?
Occasionally.
Yes.
No, I don't.
They are. They've been expanded upon.
Yeah. And so, like, things that you're doing, occasionally the game will give you a pop-up that's like, hey, you're an Earth Directorate agent. And so it's like, the Earth Directorate's discovered a flaw in you. And they are permanent attributes that you can, they're basically like perks. You can decide to take them or you can decline them. And they always have a bonus effect and a negative effect. So like one that I almost took, but I didn't, was it was like a perk happy one where you can, every time you level up, you get two perks that you unlock, but the game will choose them randomly for you on every level up, which is like could drastically change the way that you play it. The one I got was the consumerism one, where you get reduced prices for selling things to merchants, but you also get reduced prices on buying things from merchants. And I think what's interesting with a lot of the flaws is that they do serve a gameplay purpose, but I found out that like they actually unlock a surprising amount of like narrative options too. So like consumerism gave me tons of dialogue options where I could basically play into the idea of being a stupid consumer who is solely interested in buying products. So a lot of conversations, I would just be like this product-obsessed weirdo. And it's a choice. You don't have to do it. But it would give me a choice for being this product-obsessed weirdo who only cares about that kind of thing.
Mikhail mentioned in our voice chat this consumerism flaw. One of the ways, I assume there's the way you obtain it by getting the premium edition of the game, you know, obviously ironically enough. But can you also obtain this consumerism flaw in the game itself, or is it only available in this premium edition? And maybe, Mikhail, you can speak more.
I don't think either of us can comment on that because the review codes for the game were the premium edition.
Okay.
I will say, like, in-game, it doesn't tell you anything about it being exclusive.
Interesting.
The premium edition. I heard this from when I was putting together a short DLC guide on this thing. I checked in with a few people who just got the base game on Game Pass, and it did not pop up for them at all. It just popped up for me and two other people who had the premium edition. It doesn't actually tell you this when you get the prompt for it. And there's also another thing, like a bobblehead for having the what they call the season pass in game, but it's actually called the DLC pass. I think there's like some, they need to label this stuff better, but yeah, they're as far as I can tell, consumerism is for buying the premium edition.
There are a
couple of other flaws that I've seen mentioned a few times. Junior as well as Alex have mentioned this. One is more of a gameplay fallout, and I just think this is funny. It's called like bad knees, where the bonus is if you crouch a lot, you eventually gain this flaw where you like can move at normal speed while crouching. But your knees are bad, so if you stand up from crouching, they'll make a loud pop and they'll alert everyone around you.
So another one I really like that was like reckless leadership, and is like, you don't revive your teammates enough, so we're going to give you a flaw where if your teammates get downed, you cannot revive them the rest of the game. When one is downed, the second one gets like a huge buff in terms of power.
Gosh.
But yeah, even in Junior's review, he mentioned that he played the game as like a sniper, so he would like crouch around, snipe people and stuff. And then like he'd sometimes accidentally like forget and stand up, pop, and everyone around him was like, who is that? And he had to like run away because he alerted them. Another one that Alex brought up, as well as when I interviewed Matthew Singh, who is the design director at Obsidian, foot in mouth. It's a flaw called foot in mouth. And what happens, you gain this flaw when you click through dialogue too fast. Like if you click through dialogue and voice lines too much, the game recognizes this and says, gives you the foot in mouth flaw. I think the bonus is just like more EXP from dialogue, but the flaw itself is you only get a few seconds to make a choice in the game. Otherwise, it'll just choose it for you. So like all of your choices are just become randomized. And Matthew Singh, the design director, was saying, or actually it might have been Brandon Adler, the director, like you can't wait for there to be that playthrough where someone gets this flaw and then just goes with the flow. Like, I am not making any decisions. Let's just see what happens, and I'll have to deal with what I'm dealt.
I didn't take a ton of flaws on my first playthrough, but it's the kind of thing where, like, some of them could pretty drastically change how you play the game. And I think it's a really fun system that feeds into the already kind of like diversity of choice and really encourages multiple playthroughs.
I like that they're not just statistical modifiers, but they also impact like the dialogue choices. The fact that it does both things is what I think really excites me most about the idea. Go ahead, Adam.
Yeah, when Junior finished the game, you know, and this is kind of a good hallmark of a lot of these sorts of RPGs, is like, I kind of wonder how the game could have like routed itself or how things could have been different had I done other things. And it's like, it's one of those things you just playing it, you know, in the confines of a review, you know, space by yourself, like you have no idea, like, was this ending that I got a very common one, or did I do something really strange, or what would have happened had I done it this way or played this way or done this thing? And then it's only after the game's been out for a while that you start to see like, oh, maybe it wasn't as expansive as I thought, or wow, there's these very different paths. And I think that was actually a kind of a criticism on the first game that led to a lot of the, you know, the discussion around it, was that it kind of did kind of all route itself to like one ending point regardless of what you did. And like, maybe there's more, you know, choice and consequence in this version, not in just your decisions, but just in how you play. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out as people get deeper and deeper into it.
And that's such a hard thing, because like, ostensibly to me it seems like there is, but even when you have a good lead time with a game like this, like, generally just you're not gonna have time to do two like full playthroughs, you know.
For sure.
So it's so hard to like completely understand how that's going to pan out until, like you said, it's out and thousands of people are talking about their playthroughs.
Yeah. So as of this moment, like, we don't know. That's still very much up in the air on like how expansive, like, you know, the whether it's even how linear or nonlinear it is narratively, because that's so hard to account for, as you said, during the review period with only a handful of people fully, you know, getting their hands on it. As I mentioned earlier, one of the things from the first Outer Worlds that some people were kind of disappointed with as a smaller scope game from Obsidian is kind of how expansive it was, like, zone-wise. What do you think compared to, like, the first game now with Outer Worlds 2? Like, do you find that, like, the explorable space that you're in, like, more fulfilling and bigger compared to the first game?
I wouldn't say it's like a drastic leap, and I personally didn't have a huge problem with kind of the small scope of the maps. I'd say there's more locations.
Would you say, there's like more interesting stuff to find in the world, like as you're exploring, though? Like, hey, I'm going off the beaten path. Will I find something cool here? Because it felt like a lot of people didn't really
matter. Yeah, because there's a lot of like, it does a really good job with kind of stringing a lot of different little side quests along throughout each region. And side quests can oftentimes tie back into like the main narrative or tie into companions and unlock dialogue with them. And I think in general, there's still some empty space there. Like, you're not going to find interesting things everywhere you go. But I think it does a better job of kind of stringing along discoveries.
And I guess there's like a more niche question, but I always find it amusing when RPGs do it, is how do you think it's viable to like do like almost a non-fatal playthrough this game, just going by on speech?
That would be hard. You think? I have tried to get by on speech a lot, and I have been able to talk down a lot of like major enemies or villains or something like that, but I don't think it's possible to do like a complete non-lethal playthrough.
Oh, okay. I'll be interested to see, like, if like people will definitely try their damnedest to do it.
Yeah, I'm sure they will try. Yeah, but like a lot of like major moments or like named enemies, not just like the basic grunts, but named enemies, you can often like talk them down or something. But I don't see how you'd be able to make it through everything.
Interesting. And nice call out, Adam, in the voice channel chat here that we have. One of the major components in this game, obviously, is the companion system. What was your kind of general overall thoughts on like the companions that you met, who you decided to pair up with, your general, you know, takeaway from them?
I like the companions in this a lot, and I think that with Avowed earlier this year, despite I liked the companions that were there, but I think one of my complaints with that game and a lot of people's was that, like, one, there were only four companions, and two, like, they didn't feel super complex or meaningful in terms of how they tied into the story. And I think that is by and large not a problem with Outer Worlds 2, because most of the companions feel very integrated into the story, particularly because of that faction system. Because most of the companions come from a faction, there's a lot that ties into understanding the faction and its society and how your companion ties into that. And there's a few that I really like. My favorite is Marisol, who is she's part of the Order, which is like the Scientology math worshippers, basically.
Okay.
And she's essentially like a SEAL Team 6 member from the math worshippers.
All right.
She's like this elderly woman who's just, she's got such this like dry sarcasm about her. She's so much fun to bring along to everything. And I also like Niles as well, who's like the first companion you get. He's with you in the prologue, and then he's there after like the 10-year gap too. But he's like, he's kind of that like charming right-hand man companion, you know, like the best bud companion, like Garrus was in Mass Effect. Part of what I really like is that you could talk to him all the time about what happened in the 10 years when you were, before you woke up. And like, it's consistently extremely depressing because he's like, oh yeah, I was alone and like made this relationship with a robot who I know is a robot, but I'm like super attached to a robot now because I didn't have anyone else for a decade. It's just like incredibly depressing stuff. And he's so happy to have friends now. And I just find it like really sweet and charming in a ironically grim way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the companions are by and large very good. I think
that,
overall
that's cool. That's
better.
Integrated, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, overall better than the first Outer Worlds cast. Yeah. But I don't know that there's a like Marisol comes close, but I still think I like Parvati better than anyone in the Outer Worlds too. Like,
yeah, Outer Worlds 1 companion seems like Parvati was like the standout, and then everyone else,
yeah,
people forgot about.
Yeah,
but yeah, I know in Junior's review he mentioned, like, he talked about that Auntie's Choice like worker strike event that you talked about also. Mm-hmm. And like, I think it's Inez who is also basically tied up into all of that. So
yeah.
And he was discussing, you know, things he liked and things he didn't like about how that was handled, but going to show how like the faction system, the quest system, as well as the companions, there seems to be a bigger effort in sort of tying these things together with some cohesion.
What one thing I actually really like is a small detail, but sometimes in conversations, like, party member might interject and say something, or if they know the person you're talking to, they might interject. A lot of times there's an option where you can just let them keep talking and kind of like solve the conversation themselves, which is not a thing that I've really seen with companions a lot. Like, you got a lot of times where they can interject. I think it's really interesting that there's multiple instances where you can just kind of be like, you know what? You got it. So I'll just see what you do with it.
You know what game that reminds me of that I'm sad at how it turned out? Greedfall actually did that pretty well. Where, like, if you had a companion with you at certain events, you could just avoid fights. Like, because, like, oh, you know, they're able to talk them down and you can't. Like, that is not ability you have. They have the panache and like, the notoriety, and you don't. And then, of course, Greedfall 2 is, like, stuck in early access hell, and I'm sad that it turned out that way. So yeah. It's cool to hear that, because, yeah.
I guess it bears mentioning, too, in case anyone doesn't know it, that, like most Obsidian games, there's not any romance whatsoever in Outer Worlds 2. Like, there are no romance options. It is not a thing. And that's an intentional choice by Obsidian.
I get it, because if there is romance, sometimes you don't even care about, you know, the character. You're just trying to find which one is the one they like, or which choice is the one, you know, makes me more likely to hook up with them. And now you don't really, that's not even a factor. You can just think about the topic at hand and what you think about it. So
neither here nor there, but I feel like after launch, romance actually kind of had a negative impact on some of the character writing in Baldur's Gate 3 with
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's usually very tough for our games to do, but I'm curious if Outer Worlds 2 does it. Are there any times that you've observed where multiple companions like get like involved with each other's like storyline, like intersect? Or are they like just largely separate between like your main character and their relationship with that companion?
I wouldn't say they get involved insofar as like a companion can alter the story of another companion or something, but they will like talk to the companions will talk to each other at times.
And okay. Like,
on companion missions, if you have certain people with you, they might give you new different options in a conversation or might remark on something. So not like, I don't know if this is the best example, but not like Dragon Age Veilguard, where like companions could romance each other or something.
Okay.
It's not super complex like that, but there are little bits of that.
And I guess there's like a weird thing that I just totally forgot to mention, but just how do you feel about like the combat in this game, like weapon variety, weapon feel, generally like engaging like combat encounters? Like, what did you think?
I guess my short answer would be it's good. It's not like phenomenal. The gunplay and like the combat, it feels good. It's not like Call of Duty level game feel, right? But
yeah.
It's an improvement over the first one. And that's another factor that I think like it's a lot better as you get further into the game, because the first few hours you have like your machine guns and your pistols and your shotguns, and it's all just kind of like very typical weaponry. But you get a lot more bizarre weapons the further you get. I haven't gotten it yet, but another reviewer I talked to, there's a sword that you can get that's like the dubstep machine from Saints Row.
We're talking.
It's like a musical weapon.
Uh-huh.
You get damage boosts if you time your attacks with the beat.
That's so funny.
Or there's like a pistol that is an electric pistol and can auto hack machine enemies for you. There's like a random percentage chance to auto hack when you're shooting. So there's a lot of little weird weapons. Then you get more mods that can change the actual weapons you have. So like, again, the further you get in, I think the combat gets a lot better and it gets a lot more complex. The other element there is that the companions have abilities that actually like meaningfully change combat. And they have, you know, each one has like an active ability that you can prompt them to use. But like Marisol, for example, has these energy canisters that she can throw out. And as she levels up, you can change how those are used. But basically, like, she throws out these canisters and you can either pick them up yourself and get a little like armor boost, or you can shoot them when enemies are nearby and it'll do a little explosion that hits them. And so like each companion kind of has a little ability that plays more interestingly into combat.
Also, I actually talked to Brandon Adler about this, and I'll need you to verify. In the original Outer Worlds, the first game, your companions that you brought along, they boosted one of your main character's stats. So, like, if I remember correctly, Vicar Max would boost, like, your hacking ability or whatever. And what I found that I ended up doing in the original Outer Worlds is, like, I didn't even care about the companions themselves. I'm like, who gives me the certain stat boost that I want to bring along? As I understand it, Outer Worlds 2 just completely removed that element.
Yeah,
is that right? Yeah, I think that's probably for the best, because like I said, I just found myself just caring about what stats do they boost for me rather than anything else. Yeah. So they just, that's no longer
companions more play into, they more play into your combat abilities. They don't actually affect like your skills or anything. It's just strictly combat now.
One of the gameplay question I had from it's been a few years. I know Adam's played the original game more recently than I have, but one thing that I thought was a weakness of the first game was like the consumable itemization. I just remember having like a ton of different items that either healed health or whatever the energy meter was. And they were all like, they had a lot of fun flavor text and things like that, but they were all kind of the same. And it felt like it was just a mess to sort my inventory. Is that any better in the second game or done any differently?
I guess yes and no. Like, you still have a bajillion different things, but you don't really have to, like, sort them. They're strictly, like, categorized into items that boost your inhaler charges or food items. And so your inhaler charges you can use to heal during combat. You can heal with food outside of combat, but you cannot heal with food during combat. And it's all just mapped to, like, the D-pad down. You don't have to sort through anything. You have different inhaler charges that you can install in the equipment menus, which give, like, different effects. So you still have, like, dozens and dozens of items you're collecting, but you don't have to manually use or sort anything.
Okay. I mean, it wasn't a huge drawback of the first game, just something I wish was slightly better. So if it's like samesies, then that's fine.
Yeah, I'd say it's mostly samey. Yeah.
And what platform did you play this on?
Xbox Series X. I didn't have any, which I guess technical wise, like, I didn't have any real, like, frame rate or technical issues or anything. But I did have a few bugs occasionally. I had, like, hard crashes 3 times. There's a weird bug. I don't know if this is just Xbox version, but, like, if you're in the middle of a conversation and you pause it while a character is talking in the middle of a voice line, like, the rest of that voice line when you unpause will not be there. Like, the next voice line will be, but not the one you paused on.
Weird bug. I imagine they'll patch it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other big issues that, like, you noticed as you were playing?
I didn't have any huge one. Enemy AI is still a little finicky. That's a pretty common thing, even in, like, Fallout 4.
Yeah.
Or Starfield. It's just, like, I think with a game this big, I don't know that you're going to get, like, the best enemy AI out there. And I wouldn't say it's terrible, but you have occasions where they're just kind of stupid and they just run into a wall or just don't really do anything. And I wouldn't say it happens every battle or even every 5 battles, but you'll notice it occasionally.
And then, Mikhail, you were able to test this out on several platforms. What were you able to test it out on and what did you find?
Okay, so I had access to both the Steam and the Xbox versions in the end. What I did notice is, I'm curious if Haze ran into this as well. So on the Xbox version, did you play it in the quality, performance, or the balance mode?
Performance. I played in performance.
Okay, so I noticed this weird issue where, you know, the 2D art they use in the loading screen. So before the day one patch, every time it was loading, the screen used to just constantly flicker just on those screens for me. I don't know if it happened for you, but it got fixed in the day one patch for me.
No, I didn't have that at all, actually.
Oh, okay. So yeah, like on Xbox Series X, where I played it, I decided to stick with performance mode as well, and I didn't have any performance issues at all. I did have, like, a few freezes here and there, but nothing post the day one patch. It felt pretty, like, optimized and ran well, surprising for an Obsidian game on console day one. But then
on Unreal Engine 5.
Yeah, and on Unreal Engine 5 at the end. So yeah, I was a bit surprised at that. Then for the Steam version, I tested it on handhelds like I normally do. This was a little interesting because before the day one patch, I don't know if I should even call it a day one patch because the game is out on the 29th for everyone. It's just out now for the premium edition. But whatever patch shipped 2 days before embargo or 1 day before, 2 days before, yeah. So before that, it was unplayable on Steam Deck. It used to, like, 20 FPS at best in the open world. And I actually tried to be good and, like, schedule time and schedule my articles well. So I had written most of it up and I just said it's unplayable on Steam Deck. But then your day one patch arrived and it's actually really good there with some caveats. So yeah, it's on Steam Deck. If you play with the TSR, which is usually the best upscaling to use in Unreal Engine 5 games on PC in my testing, except for DLSS, obviously, it's 30 FPS. Yeah, so XeSS with a asterisk that only on James' handheld, which no one in the world owns besides him. I mean, yeah, jokes aside, it's basically XeSS on Intel-based hardware where it actually works well and is not software-based. Software-based XeSS has some more issues. Like, like Outer Worlds 2 has on Steam Deck and Rogue Ally. But right now, it's a little weird because, you know, the Rogue Ally is more powerful than the Steam Deck, but it has constant Unreal Engine stutter to the point where I just did not want to play it over there even for testing, because while running around in the open world, I was getting motion sickness on the Rogue Ally, even if I played it at like 360p. So I just said, like, I'm not dealing with Unreal Engine on Windows again, except for work. Steam Deck is, I'd say, after a few patches, it'll get to a very good state, but right now it's playable if you want to. And there's no stuttering, thankfully. Like, you can get it to, like, have decent frame times and stuff. And one thing I did notice is the game has Xbox login, like, as an option on Windows, but not on Steam Deck. So, like, you can actually have your Steam version pulled from the Xbox saves on Windows, but not on Steam. So, yeah, but, like, in the end, I'm just playing it on Xbox because it runs really nicely on the Series X. Happy with that. Enjoying what I played of the game as well. So, I was going to say that I'll get to it when, like, the releases kind of slow down, but I don't think that's happening before Christmas at this rate.
Yeah. I guess for people who are interested in playing Outer Worlds 2 on Steam Deck, kind of just, like, give it to them up front here. Like, can they expect only to cap it at 30 FPS?
So basically, the opening 2 hours of the game are not representative of how you'll be able to experience the Outer Worlds 2, because it's a very, like, confined and kind of corridor, like, focused experience where you go through, like, these narrow places. There's kind of a big tutorial area where you fight, like, mechs and stuff and all that. But then once you actually start, and over here you can actually get it to, like, 50 and 60 FPS with it looking really nice. But once you get to the open world, like, the first biome and stuff over there, it tanks completely, so you have to cap it to 30 FPS, and you will have some drops to like 28 and 27 at worst while sprinting and during combat at the same time. So this was like a good stress test, but otherwise you're getting like a 30 FPS with minor drops experience in the open world, which I think is quite good for an open world Unreal Engine 5 game on handheld. But yeah, you're playing at the low settings with upscaling, so this is still better than how Avowed ran on Steam Deck and basically any Unreal Engine 5 big game. So it's a 30 FPS experience on Steam Deck right now, basically. But HDR works. Looks quite nice.
Okay, thank you for that report. Is there anything else that, like, I'm just totally blanking on about this game, Hayes or anyone else, that you think is worth mentioning?
I think we've covered most everything, like, pretty comprehensively, obviously. Not everything, but
In general, you know, you just think it's a stronger game overall than the first, and, you know,
I think large view, like, it's a better, more refined version of the first Outer Worlds. But like I said earlier, there were parts of the first Outer Worlds you didn't like. There are probably going to be parts of this that you didn't like, particularly if you're looking at kind of writing or the narrative structure or companions or things like that.
I have a question for you. Have you played Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 and 2?
I've played 1. I unfortunately have not played 2 because I think I was reviewing like 2 other things when the second game came out.
I was just curious because a few of my friends have mentioned that they think the Outer Worlds 2 in, like, quality and scope feels like Kingdom Come Deliverance 1 to 2, so I was just curious if you felt the same.
Knowing what I know of those games, I could see that. Maybe not as drastic, but I could see that. I could see where they're coming from with that comparison.
Okay. Well, I just want to say, like, thank you so much for coming on to talk about it. Like, I think we're about to say the same thing, effectively, just having Hayes as the opportunity to speak to the game. And obviously, we're drawing from our own experience with Outer Worlds 1, other Obsidian games, Junior's review, and then having Hayes on be able to talk about his experience with Outer Worlds 2. Just thank you so much for leading the conversation.
Of course. Yeah, thank you. I'm always happy to come on and talk about what I can.
And I guess for programming notes, just logistics wise, did you want to stay on like for the more of it, or if you had other personal obligations, we totally understand too.
Normally, I'd stay on. I think just looking at the time, I think I might hop off here.
Thank you so much, Hayes. Yeah, we really appreciate your time then taking us, you know, educating us about, you know, The Outer Worlds 2.
Before you jump off, what is your opinion on Toho?
I don't know much about Toho these days.
Me too.
Like in high school, Fantasy Maiden Wars, I was like, I haven't even heard of that game. And then I was like, oh, that's that Toho game that's coming out.
All I know is it's Toho Super Robot Wars.
I played it. We're about to get into it.
I was going to say, my friend kept talking about the OST, how you kept buying the OST from BL sites, and he said you get it all on that package. It's like, you got to listen to OST. That's what he says.
That is what I know the most about Toho, because like high school and then early years of college, I remember like, yeah, the music was so good.
Once again, thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Thanks for having me on. Like I said, anytime, I'm happy to be on. And everyone have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, before you hop off, like, you know, where can people find you on the internet? Tell us what you're up to, you know, the usual.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Most of my writing you can find at inverse.com. I occasionally appear on Rolling Stone as well. You can find me on Blue Sky at Soul Fleet. And sometime in the next month, keep an eye out, I will be launching a newsletter of my own that's entirely RPG focused. So
awesome.
I'm excited for that. I think it's coming together well, and I hope I can share it soon.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obviously just reach out to us if you want to like talk about it here on the podcast, talking about it. You know, we're always happy to have you on.
Cool, perfect. All right, talk to y'all later.
Thank you. All right, moving on, our next game, as we already mentioned at the top of the program here, recently came out a few days ago, and I talked about it when it was initially announced for localization, official localization. This is Fantasy Maiden Wars, Dream of the Stray Dreamer. Quite a handful of a title here. And when it was first announced for official English localization earlier this year, this is kind of like almost a big deal in that circle of, this is a fan-made Toho game. This is, you know, many, many, many of those. But obviously the creator of Toho, Zune, totally supports, you know, people making, you know, whatever they want out of the IP that he officially created many years ago on this shmup franchise. And Fantasy Maiden Wars is an interesting one because I'm trying to remember when it officially released. Let me go try to search that up. I believe like the complete box of this game came out like in 2019, and it got but it released episodically up until then, and I forgot when the original releases came out, and this like came out like within like four episodes, and it just built on top of it until like it reached like almost 100 main stages. So this is quite a big game, and the original name of it was like Genso Shoujo Wars. And so this game, the developers of it, I believe, are Sunbondo, the name of the group. And this was the release of this in the West was officially published by a company called Phoenix Inc. And they have also published a whole bunch of other works, including like Toho Genso Wanderer, a recent game with the Hololive IP. It's like Vubuki Zero In on Hollow Earth, and that was like a side scroller game. So they've done a whole bunch of like publishing of like just indie projects. And Fantasy Maiden Wars, I've only played like several hours of it, but it's already doing many interesting things. If you don't know Toho, as you heard on this earlier, me too, I don't know much of Toho. I know Reimu, I know now of Marissa, and
that's basically all I know from like covering random like news posts here and there. It's like, okay, one of the characters is Reimu and one of them is Marissa, and that is it. And they're like witches or something?
Okay, Vermilla is a vampire. She's the last boss of Embodiment of the Scarlet Devil.
Oh, that makes sense.
The sixth Toho game. She's a vampire. And then you usually get to play as her her servant, which is the... She's the main character of... what is that game? the one Toho Luna Knights. I'm sure.
Oh yeah, I played Toho Luna Knights. Yeah, Toho Luna Knights. Like me and James definitely are fans of like a Metroid, well-made Metroidvania.
Yeah, that's our servant. So she's basically the second last boss in that game. So
yeah,
it's like, so, and now after that, she's like an official part of the team in most games.
Yeah. So if you don't know Toho, it's totally fine when you start the new game on this. It'll give you a basic rundown of like, hey, here's what the Gensokyo realm is and how it was separated from the human realm. So everything that happens here, it's like a tale about like shrine maidens and spirits and all this stuff. And the main setup of this game is like there's this red scarlet mist that has been like it has mysteriously popped up in the realm of Gensokyo. And you can, at the very beginning of this game, you can go through either Reimu's route or Marissa's route. And my understanding is that when it gets to other episodes later, it starts introducing, like, you know, other different routes on other different characters and so on. But so it's a very basic setup of like, hey, you got to investigate the cause of this red mist. And along the way, you start bumping into many other characters in the Toho IP. I don't know much about them. It's totally fine. It's kind of like, you know, it has a really basic story setup, has like some, obviously some comedic elements, because kind of the spirit of the Toho IP is like, hey, these characters are kind of goofs. And they're all having a good time, but you know, but they're all very capable when it comes to combat. So in this game, it's a strategy RPG, very much in the style of Super Robot Wars, where every character that you come across and you recruit and so on, they have these things called spirits, and the spirits are like buffs that you can cast on characters. Like some of the buffs are like, hey, for this turn, you can increase your accuracy and evasion by 30%. Another one of those could be like, hey, in this next combat encounter with this foe, you'll have a guaranteed 100% accuracy, and you'll be able to evade the incoming attack if they counterattack you in this combat exchange. If not, you get to store that, you know, guaranteed evasion for the next combat encounter.
Those are Super Robot Wars mechanics, like
completely. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that's straight up lifted from SRW, and that's, you know, it's a fan game based on you know, commemorating, you know, that franchise. So, and as you like go into combat with foes too, it does have like that that Super Robot Wars battle animation where you go to a screen and it'll show you like the combat animation of your character attacking them based on what attack move you chose. So every attack move in the game has their own unique animation. Some are more elaborate than others. Obviously, like the more involved ones that consume a lot of mana or you need to build up a certain like resource to even use in the first place. You know, those will have more elaborate animations. Like one of the ones for Reimu is like the evil sealing spell or the fantasy seal. You know, those have like, you know, way more involved animations. Like, hey, she has like a zoom in on this one of like her sealing this opponent. It does a lot of damage and so forth. Very much over the top in the ways that Super Robot Wars does. Also has like that support attack and support defense mechanic, like in SRW. Like if you're by someone and they have this either support attack or support defense skill, they'll block the incoming attack or reduce damage. They'll take the hit for you, or they'll attack alongside you for this next attack. Very basic ground level SRW stuff. The things that makes this like different and the way that makes this try to distinguish itself is that it also, you know, pays homage to the Toho IP as a shoot 'em up franchise. So, unlike those Super Robot Wars games, this game actually has like a mode toggle called Focus. Not to be confused with the Focus Spirit in those games. This has like a Focus mode and Unfocused mode, where there are some enemies that have a D label on them. Like over their sprite, there's like the letter D, and that's to show that they're a Danmaku enemy. They have a zone around them that will inflict stat penalties on you if you are unfocused and try to attack them. That's not to say that like it's impossible to hit them or you'll do low damage, but there are definitely, like, say if you're in the zone of this Danmaku enemy, they might have a stat penalty of like accuracy lowered accuracy against them, like minus 10 or 15%, and they might do a little bit more damage if you were to attack them in this unfocused state. So you want to go to this focus mode, and when you're in this focus mode, your movement is decreased, but you're able to negate those stat penalties when you're attacking them in that zone of influence that this Danmaku has. And it's kind of transitioning this mechanic of, like, you know, in shoot 'em up games, when you have like when you fire, sometimes you fire like horizontally and you have like wide arc spread coverage. But then, like, when you for some shoot 'em up games, you can like hone in that firing arc to a more focused zone in front of you, and you might move slower in those games. Some shoot 'em up games as well have a mechanic where when you're not shooting at all, your ship will move faster, but as soon as you start shooting, you'll have a lowered movement speed in exchange. So it's sort of trying to have some of those staple shoot 'em up genre mechanics, and how would those, you know, be integrated to the strategy RPG format, which is like it really interesting, you know, because you have to kind of make some interesting trade-offs, because I'm playing on hard mode, so enemies do deal a lot of damage, so I do have to make this mental calculation of like, okay, how much HP am I willing to, you know, potentially shave off in exchange for like more firepower to kind of focus fire on this enemy that is actively threatening my team just by existing because of their zone of influence. And that also translates into another mechanic in this game that's not in the SRW series called the spell card. So there are some boss enemies where they'll like activate like a powered up state. They'll activate their spell card mechanic, and like and it's only up there for like a certain amount of turns. Like the first one you encounter in the game is this you encounter this character called Sakuya, which is like this maid for Remilia, I think, or whatever. But you're first introduced to this mechanic, and she activates her spell card when you first hit her, because for that stage she's trying to retreat off the battlefield. And one of the fail states of that is like, hey, you lose the stage if Sakuya successfully escapes. So you have to rush to her and hit her to like activate like her AI so she stops retreating, but she'll start actively attacking you instead. And she hurts a lot. So you have to kind of make this mental calculation of like overextending to make sure she doesn't retreat off the battlefield. But as soon as you hit her, she'll activate her spell card. It lasts for 4 turns. And it has like you know, has like a big spell circle around her sprite, and so there's an AoE field around her. And if you're in this field, like the Danmaku field of these enemies, your accuracy is slashed by -40%. And unlike the Danmaku enemies, whether you're focused or unfocused, it does not matter. It will not negate this accuracy -40% debuff. So, you have to really rely on like spirits that guarantee either hitting her or raising that accuracy percentage for that fight, that encounter with her. So you're very reliant on the toolkits, the spirit buffs of your squad. And it makes this kind of interesting dynamic exchange, because this spell card really pushes you to think about funneling your resources for this really dangerous encounter with Sakuya instead of like trying to spread it out amongst enemies. Like, you do regain 10 spirit points per turn, but some of these, you know, spirit skills like cost like 20, 25. You can't be spamming them every turn. You have to kind of think about, you know, conserving them for that boss fight with her. And I haven't really gotten that far into the game yet of how spell cards will, how you can utilize spell cards on your own. I'm not sure if like your characters can do it or not. I think you can, but it really reminded me of like older SRW games, because unlike modern SRW games, they kind of, even on hard mode, kind of baby the player a bit too much, kind of swing the pendulum more in the player's favor. So in some respect, it kind of is mindless in the mainline SRW series. While in this one, like in Super Robot Wars Z, for example, when you're starting off that game, you're really, really feeling that spirit point resource. Like, just you start with a very low amount, and you really have to think about like when to deploy them in the middle of combat. And this game really reminds me of really older SRW games where it really pushed players to think about resource conservation, when to dump their resources onto a certain battle, and kind of reintroducing the challenge that, like, you know, a lot of modern SRW games don't really provide, for better or for worse, you know. But I really enjoy when SRW games are really pushing me to think about resource management in that regard.
You're going to make Adam play this game if you keep saying resource
management. I love Toho and...
There you go. But in general, I think we never want to play an RPG where there's a system, whether it's an MP resource or even just like currency, where you get where it's so plentiful and easy to access that it stops being a mechanic, that it just no longer matters. Like, there's no decision to be made. Just choose your strongest skill every time.
I have a game for you. It's called Varlet.
Oh, wait, boy. Varlet.
Yeah, Varlet mentioned the big year 2025. It came out this year, too. But yeah, I really enjoy that aspect of it. Like, hey, there's a lot of like bringing that strategy aspect back into the strategy RPG genre. But you can feel its limitations as a fan game, obviously, right? Where, you know, a lot of the attack animations maybe aren't as like exquisite or as like lavishly produced as like SRW games, where, like, you know, they actually had like, you know, a really involved development team over the several years. And trying to, like, you know, make it as faithful as they can to, like, the mecha series that they're producing. And obviously, and they have a lot of resources for it, budgetary, schedule-wise, you know, like, a lot of developers on it, and so forth. And that's one of the concessions that you'll make with this game. Like, hey, unlike the Super Robot Wars games, when you're doing an attack animation, you know, they're all unvoiced. This whole game is unvoiced. Unlike the SRW games, where obviously a large chunk of the story exchanges, the intermission story scenes, are unvoiced, but when it comes to, you know, battle animations, you know, you'll hear all the iconic lines from the pilots of those shows, do those, like, you know, perform those lines, and you'll feel like you're, you know, it's like, wow, they really recreated, like, you know, that moment in the anime series to, like, a really amazing effect. While in this one, you know, everything's unvoiced, but in exchange, kind of like the weird instance, when you're first going to the store page of this game, it's like, wait a minute, why does the cost of this, the video game, why is it more cheaper to buy the game than it is to buy the OST? Because the without the discount, this game is $35 USD, but the soundtrack for this game is $40. And you're like, wait a minute, that's really weird. And it's because the soundtrack for this game over this year is fucking massive. It's like a fucking 12 to 13 disc OST of all the tracks of this game. And like, when you look at the library of this game, like, how many tracks are in this game? It's like, it's just shy of like 200 tracks in this game of all just Toho music. And they're all like fucking awesome too. And it's like, holy shit, there's like a whole bunch of like different unique themes in this game that, you know, Even the SRW entries of like that have like a lot of music cannot compare to like the sheer amount of music that is in this game. It's jam packed with Toho music. And what I really loved, a very early observation I made in this game, and I was looking at the library of this game, like, a lot of the tracks, all the tracks, you have to unlock. Like, the only way you can unlock a track in this game to listen for in the library is like you have to hear it once in the middle of combat. And some of these tracks are like kind of sneaky because some tracks are like only play during a certain attack with a character. Like the track for when you use the headbutt attack on one of your characters, that is a unique track that only plays for that character when they use that attack. That's the only time you'll find that track. And when you scroll through all the tracks that you unlocked in the library, they all have unique liner notes, all different unique comments on, like, from the arranger of like, hey, what was the thought process of like composing this track or like arranging this track in this way for this game, you know? And it's like, it's all localized. Man, it's fucking awesome.
I love that shit. I wish more games did that, because I know that the Great Ace Attorney Chronicles had something like that in the extras, where they had like notes about some songs.
Yeah,
and it's like, yeah, man.
Like this game is a very, 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 very passionate, driven, developed community. Both like in the original dev work that went into it, and obviously the localization work that went into the original fan localization or fan translation, and then went to the official localization. It's like just from top to bottom, very much like a passion project on this game. Obviously, it's a very, very long game. I've yet to like even I'm like kind of chipping away at it when I have time. Obviously, there are other games that I'm getting to as well. But I'm just like, man, this is it, like, even if I'm not like a total Toho newbie, I've played a little bit of the shmups here and there. I played some of the fan games, but like, I can't really wrap my head around, you know, the whole series because there's so much to it. But even like playing the small slice that I did, I'm like, man, it's all like, this game is like really, really, really cool. The things that I have like issue with is like, it's like a very bare bones release, like PC port features wise, like there's no resolution options. And it wasn't until a very recent patch that like recently came out, like in the last day or two, as of the day of this recording, like they didn't have support for like Steam Cloud, which, you know, this would be a great game to play on the Steam Deck and just play on the go, you know, when you're passing the time. And like one of the weird major complaints that I had for this game, like when it first launched, was like, there's no Steam Cloud support. So you had to commit to whether, like, you know, starting their game on desktop or the deck, and there was like no save data transfer via the cloud. And like a lot of people shared that complaint. And like within the, like the past day or two, they patched in Steam Cloud support. So now that makes it easier to just kind of play it, you know, on the go.
Mikhail, that reminds me.
Oh, sorry. Go for it.
No, James. No, Mikhail, you got Mikhail, go first.
Okay.
No, so for me, Super Robot Wars is kind of like how this game is for you, because when I first bought Super Robot Wars, I don't remember if X or V came out first, but those were my first two. So when I bought those, I wasn't familiar with most of those properties, and I still am not with Super Robot Wars. So it's kind of like just introducing these different IP, which I learn about through the game. And Toho stuff is kind of the same. Like, I have no idea about the stuff besides the... What is the first localized game it's released on console? Was it something Xseed released or something?
For which one? For Toho or Super Robot?
Yeah, for Toho. No, for Toho. For Toho. Oh, there was something which...
Yeah,
I feel like Xseed released something. Yeah, so it was that. And then after that, they started releasing the official Toho games on Steam without English support. And I started buying those. And then it was the Team Ladybug game, which I played and enjoyed. And now it's this, like, I've just a few hours into Fantasy Maiden Wars on Steam Deck. And yeah, it's just learning about these characters through another, like, fan game, essentially. It's kind of funny, similar to Super Robot Wars for me. But yeah, I am glad they added Steam Cloud. I get very annoyed when a game does not have Steam Cloud. And I look at the Steam page now before I buy a game, because if it doesn't have cloud support, it's just not worth my time. Like, yeah. Someone needs to tell Inti Creates to do that for Dragon Marked for Death. Like, every time I talk to the PR person, I mention that, like, PS, I hope the team considers adding this. Like, I will never give up.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I first reviewed Fuga Melodies of Steel, I said, man, it would be great if it had Steam Cloud support. And then eventually they went back and added it, which was nice.
Brian, did they ever add Steam Cloud support to Outward?
I don't remember.
I remember that was a weird hang-up.
The one trouble that I had recently was that the Oblivion remaster, the Steam Cloud only worked if your saves were like in default save location, because I don't have them in a default location. I have them in like where I want them, and it works for like 95% of Steam Cloud games, but for the Oblivion remaster it didn't, and it was very frustrating. It's you just kind of take Steam Cloud for granted when it works 90% of the time for most releases.
Yeah, one thing that's crazy is that I remember I played through Volume 1 of .hack.gu, and at the time it had Steam Cloud saves, and when I got my Steam Deck, I was like, wait a second, I could have swore this had Steam Cloud, because I'd played it on my desktop and my laptop at the time. Somehow, they removed Steam Cloud from that, for whatever fucking reason.
That's crazy. What the hell? That's a new one. I didn't know you could the developers just remove Steam Cloud after implementing it. Huh. Yeah, I mean, like, so far, like, you know, still early on, still kind of discovering, like, you know, systems opening up, but I've been having a really good time with it so far. Just like I said, the my main issues is obviously, like, you know, it's a very bare bones PC port, and I kind of wish it had more. You know, I get over it. It's easy enough. I'm, you know, big shout outs to everyone who was able to get involved in, like, making this official release happen for this game, because I know it's just, like, it's been just, once again, I've heard so many good things about this game over the years, and I'm just like, I'll get it when it's easy, and now it's easy to get it, so can't complain anymore.
And there was one other release that I'd admittedly forgotten about over the last week that Mikhail was able to very quickly cover for us. I forgot, and I shouldn't forget this because I'm on this podcast every week, that Persona 3 Reload was launching on Switch 2. So I launched on Switch 2. Just Mikhail, just very quickly, like, you were able to give this a tryout on the newest console. Thumbs up or thumbs down
for Persona 3 Reload? So I joked about how it's like a 5 or 6 out of 10 port of a 9 out of 10 game, because that's essentially what it is. I wasn't even sure how to approach the review, because I was first in two minds whether I want to do like a whole technical thing, but then I thought I'd save that for a separate thing and just like focus on itself. But I ended up doing like half and half with it. But yeah, it's not great. They've even done an interview with Nintendo Life where they kind of like maybe didn't want to, I don't think they should have done the interview basically, but it feels like they implied it was a rushed port for the holidays and that they will be addressing or like working on the performance issues, because the problem is not 30 fps. like, if a game is 30 fps and it runs at a stable 30 fps, I'll deal with it. It's not a big deal for me. The problem with this is it just feels like dog shit handheld mode with the frame pacing issues. And, like, what happens is when you're moving the camera in Tartarus and stuff, it sometimes just eats your inputs, and it's just not a good handheld experience right now. And, like, why would you buy this game on Switch 2 if you weren't going to just play it handheld, is how I see it. Like, you've had access to play it on every other platform dirt cheap. Like, it's been $20 multiple times. So they delivered, like, a conservative docked experience with this, and the handheld is just not fun. I couldn't play it for more than like half an hour handheld without getting motion sickness, so I stuck to playing Doc Beyond.
I just don't fucking get, like, I know it's an early port, and like realistically a couple years from now this won't be a problem, but it's like, man, more devs need to get used to using DLSS, because it's fine to render internally at like 540p, which the Switch can absolutely fucking handle in handheld mode, and just upscaling with DLSS to 1080p. That's, I just don't know, man.
The thing about that is, even if we forget the, like, you know, forget the upscaling or whatever, I don't know how they've messed up the frame rate cap so badly with this, because I literally have never played a game with such bad frame pacing, like, in the last 10 years probably. And I've played, like, I played, what, 10 hours of Space Marine 2 on Steam Deck pre-day one patch, where it literally used to drop to 15 FPS. And I think, you know, the more I played Persona 3 Reload, it reminded me of how Daemon X Machina Titanic Scion had so many people complaining about the performance. And I was a little surprised by that, because it runs about 100 times better than the first game did on Switch 1. So I was like, why are people like saying the performance is so bad? Then I realized that this is because you have like hitching and stuttering, which is more like noticeable than just like frame rates dropping from 30 to 20. Like, that's, it's kind of like, you know, Link's Awakening and Echoes of Wisdom, the stupid double buffered V-Sync. You can immediately tell it starts becoming slow. So this has those kinds of issues where it's not just the frame rate is not great. The frame pacing and like hitching is just, it makes it feel bad. So that was like one major issue with the port. The second thing is like you're charging $60, not including any DLC. And you have day one, $60 plus a premium upgrade plus episode, I guess. So you're essentially paying like $140 or $130 to get everything. And, you know, like, the DLC in this is kind of pointless because it's cosmetic and personas and all that. But you're still selling a nearly 2 year late port with bad performance handheld and with none of the DLC included. So in the end, like, I was playing it docked and enjoying it because, like, I love Persona 3 Reload. Like, I know some people don't like it and prefer the original or whatever. That's fine with me. I've played P3 FES. I played P3P multiple times. I enjoy Reload revisiting it more because Tartarus doesn't annoy me here. So I was enjoying revisiting it, and in the end, I was like actually in two minds about the score, but like I've started leaning into going lower and I'm happy with the score I gave this. So yeah, it's unfortunate that they decided to release it in this state, because you have so many good Switch 2 ports and you have this, like, you know, Atlas's Raidu remastered. I thought that was kind of a bare bones port or whatever, but that's the best way to play it on the go. With the Persona 3 Reload, it's the worst way to play it in general, because even if you dock your Steam Deck and you play it at the same resolution the Switch 2 is at, you can get it running much better than the Switch 2 is even docked. Like if I want to play at Switch 2 frame rate, I can aim for 1440p docked. I don't even need to settle for 1080. So they really like were too conservative with this, and I hope they manage fixing it, because if this is how P3R, a game which runs at 60 FPS locked without breaking a sweat on Steam Deck, is, imagine what's going to happen with Metaphor. I mean, like, Josh and I played that pre-release, like, yeah, that's kind of rough in general. Technically, imagine what happens with that.
Oh, Metaphor, I'm expecting to be similar issues to Elden Ring, because it's like, Metaphor isn't that demanding on the GPU, but because of how old it is, the CPU limitation is like very heavily single threaded. So I don't see the Switch 2 running that particularly well, considering like CPU is like the weak point.
So yeah, like just P3R is, I mean, the good thing is there's a demo. So if you're not sure whether you will be able to tolerate the frame rate or not, I would recommend downloading the demo. Running around in the school when you have free camera control, and also getting to Tartarus and seeing how you feel handled, because that's a good representation of the full game. Oh yeah, and speaking of running around in the school, the Switch 2 version, despite being 1080p 30fps, it does not have any of the reflections that the PS5 and Series X versions have. So those are like 4K 60 with ray trace reflections. This one is 1080 30 with bad 30fps and no ray trace reflection. So yeah, very conservative. And download the demo before you buy it, because don't buy it without that. That's all.
Yeah. Hey, good on them for providing a demo and having a good representative. Like, hey, this is what you're signing up for.
Yes, thank you for the very earnest look at the Switch 2 version of Persona 3 Reload, and that's actually going to be a decent tether into a relatively short news section of the podcast here. Now that we've gotten all of our features and games discussions, we talked about the Outer Worlds 2, we have the review on our site from Junior, the review on Inverse from Hayes, the Persona 3 Reload Switch 2 review up on the site from Mikhail. Oh, and I don't want to forget Adam's interview with Obsidian regarding the Outer Worlds 2. That interview is up on the site as well. Going into news, I'm gonna jump ahead in our outline here, because one of the themes of the week was kind of details for announced and upcoming Switch 2 ports. So we talked about Persona 3 Reload. A few other announcements here about some games coming to Switch 2 and some games decidedly not coming to Switch 2. Assassin's Creed Shadows is going to be releasing on Switch 2 on December 2nd. Owlcat has announced that Warhammer 40K Rogue Trader will launch also in December for Switch 2. That's a really fun one to see, like an isometric CRPG on the Switch 2. And then the System Shock remake from a few years back, not the 2 remaster, the remake from 2022 or whenever that was, is also coming to Switch 2 and will support the mouse controls.
I wonder if that'll have the ray tracing.
I'm not sure. Like, I just rattled these off like really quickly, like it. Because these are all real, it's real cool to see. I remember whenever there's a new Nintendo console, it's like, is this the one that third parties are going to get, you know, are gonna jump in on and support? And every year it feels like some people are satisfied and many people aren't. But it's cool to see games like Assassin's Creed and Rogue Trader make their way over to Nintendo's handheld.
Yeah, I wonder about Shadows of who's doing the porting, because I've heard good things about the Star Wars Outlaws port to Switch 2, so I wonder if they have the similar porting team that, because they could apparently pull off magic.
The thing with Shadows is the Shadows scales quite a bit better than Outlaws does on, like, in general on low-end systems, and Shadows is playable without forced ray tracing as well, while Outlaws is unplayable on like handhelds more or less, except I don't know about James's handheld if he's tried Outlaws, but it's not playable on Steam Deck, and ROG Ally is like kind of dog shit as well with Outlaws. So Assassin's Creed Shadows works though well on both of those. So I imagine if it gets the same care and attention that Outlaws port got, it might even be like the best looking port immediately on the Switch too, because Shadows is quite a good looking game on console. So we'll see how that was. I'm very curious about Rogue Trader, because it is not, like, at least at launch, it was pretty rough on console, like on PS5 when I played it. So I'm curious about that. And for System Shock, it's interesting that System Shock 2, System Shock, the remake of System Shock 1, I believe it was from 2023. They're doing both of them at the same time, Switch 1 and Switch 2. But System Shock 2, which came out in like a few months ago, was only on Switch 1. So I wonder if they are going to go back and offer a Switch 2 upgrade for that, because they've been promoting the mouse controls and gyro support quite a bit for the System Shock remake port. And there was a fourth game which was announced as well, right? I forgot. I think Adam posted about it.
Fallout. Yeah, that's, I have that in a different section. Yeah. The fourth game that I listed here, yeah. So we'll talk about Fallout next, is I also listed that Alchemia Interactive has announced that the Gothic 1 remake will not be coming to Switch 2, which is a pretty, like, normally developers avoid, like, absolute statements like that, but
yeah,
they're, as far as I can tell, they were pretty absolute, saying, Switch 2 is a great console, but we think we have a different development approach. We are trying to push the limits for the current generation, and we don't think Switch 2 is at that level. Basically, they just said it's underpowered. And it's just kind of, I'm not saying they're wrong or right. I'm just saying the candor, I'm not used to seeing it at that, quite that level. But yeah, Gothic remake, not planned for Switch 2.
I mean, good on them for, like, just being, like, honest up front, like, hey, we can't do it. We tried, can't do it. So, you know, I think the most interesting thing here also is, like, with Rogue Trader coming to Switch 2, I'm interested to see what sort of features they're going to have for it in terms of, like, hey, there's a lot of text in that game at any given time on the HUD. So
yeah,
I have to imagine, like, font size has to be a priority for them in getting that right. Good luck, Alcat. You know, it's not an easy feat on getting that right. So hopefully, they do think about, like, a lot of, like, different features, like how to best play that game on handheld, on the go. So ambitious endeavor.
Wrath of the Righteous did make its way to Switch.
That was the cloud version, though.
Yeah.
Both the Pathfinder games, I believe, were cloud versions. If the first one is also there, I can't remember.
And the Rogue Trader on my PC, it, like, ran my CPU, like, really hot. Like, it was okay, but I was just like, man, this is stressing out my system quite a lot. It's like as equivalent to, like, really, I don't know. There's a lot going on in that game. Just because it's isometric doesn't mean that it's, like, lightweight.
Yeah. Keep an ear out for your Switch 2 fans. They might be crying for help. You know, it kind of just an off topic, but just I remember all the jokes of, like, when Atlas and Vanillaware announced that they were going to port 13 Sentinels to Switch 1. And everyone's like, is your Switch 1 going to go light on fire during battles? Like, how's that going to go?
With all, like, the missile.
Because there's, like, very, very obvious frame drops and performances and issues with the PS4 version of that game. So it's like, how is Switch 1 gonna run on this? And they just scaled back on a lot of stuff. The smart move, but it was very funny jokes.
I was trying to remind myself of that anime term when, like, where they do the tracking shots and all the missiles. The Itano Circus. Like, it does a lot of that in that game. But yeah, we mentioned it in passing that we brought it up, I think, 2 weeks ago, that they were having a 2025 Fallout streaming event. And there were a lot of rumors and scuttlebutt about what was going to be there. I think people were like, they're going to do a remaster in the vein of Oblivion. They're going to shadow drop it. And there was a few things that we kind of expected. Like, we knew that Fallout 76 was going to get a new update, that they'd probably date that. So the outcome ended up being pretty much right in the middle. So I just figured I'd just kind of rattle off these headlines here. Fallout 76 is going to get the Burning Springs update on December 2nd. I believe this ties in, at least loosely, to the TV show. Fallout 4 Anniversary Edition was announced, but this is not a remaster. It is just a kind of a gold edition that includes the official expansions and a lot of the, like, Creation Club content. So it basically just bundles it into one neat package, but it's the existing version of the game. But it is also coming to Switch 2, so that.
They did say that this is the first time creations are going to be available in Fallout 4. Now, I have not played recent versions of Fallout 4. I think I just tested the when they pushed out the next gen update. Was it last year? I just tried that a bit on Xbox, but I haven't looked into mods on console for this. I did some for Skyrim when they added that, but they seem to imply that Creation Club mods are going to be in Fallout 4 for the first time. I cannot verify that, but that's what Bethesda is saying.
I vaguely remember people saying like a lot of things broke when they did that update on Fallout 4. It was like the first update in the game in like 4 or 5 years, and a lot of people weren't too happy. I vaguely remember that.
That happened to me with Skyrim, because when they pushed out the anniversary update, like regardless of whether you bought the upgrade, they still pushed out some stuff for free to the base game, and that corrupted my save on 3 platforms, which I will not forgive them for. But hoping, like, I don't know if that's going to happen with this, but thankfully when I do play Fallout 4, whatever edition they're releasing now, I'll start a new save. I'm not risking anything, but they seem to imply that the creation stuff is for the first time, so I don't know whether these mods are going to be here for the first time or how it's going to work. And they haven't even said anything about a physical, because I thought the whole point of like a new SKU is to have something on the shelves for holidays, and maybe they'll, like, you know, put the TV show branding on it or something like that. I don't know, but yeah, it's coming to PlayStation and Xbox first, and then and PC obviously, and then Switch 2 is coming in 2026. No idea who's doing the port or anything, but yeah, like you said, like I was expecting Fallout 3 remastered, like the Oblivion thing. Maybe they want to give it some space between releases, because that was kind of in, I believe The Verge reported some leaked internal documents during the Activision Blizzard court stuff that's where Oblivion and Doom the Dark Ages were like listed for the first time, and there was a Fallout 3 remaster also there. So maybe it still happens next year.
I admittedly haven't really followed like kind of the whole Creation Club mod scene and how they handle it there. But if anyone else listening knows, like, how do they do profit sharing with the people who create these Creation Club items, or is there like just a blanket contract that like, hey, if you create stuff for the Creation Club, it's marketedly ours, and that's just, you know, we take ownership of it. And we're free to redistribute it at our own leisure without any profit sharing. Like, I just don't know how that any of that's
anyone. I just, yeah, I don't interface with any of that stuff, so I just don't know the answer.
Okay.
I'm looking it up right now, and there's apparently the Creation Club was since 2017, like I didn't realize that. I thought it was newer.
Yeah, for I some remember reason. That coming out. Yeah. I just don't know how that works.
From a report on GameDeveloper.com, it says there's something about 25% of the revenue paid mods allowed. I'm not seeing like 100% like yes or no on how it works, but they've put up this whole thing about the pros and cons of the Creation Club, so I've just linked that in our voice chat. It's too long for us to discuss right now, but it is something.
I'm very interested to into. Interested to if anyone's like anyone done any investigative reporting. So I'd be interested to listen, reading about that.
And the other Fallout headline was the announcement of a Fallout New Vegas 15th anniversary bundle, but it's interesting enough, but it's the existing. I saw someone call it. It's the existing busted PC version of the game. Like it's not a new software project. This is just a new collector's edition, effectively, where you get a statue of the, I forget what the name of those one wheeled robots. Well, I know his name is Victor. I was trying to think like the model of his robot, but I forget. Victor. Securitron. That's the name. Yeah. So with Victor, you get some art cards, you get a patch that's for the new California Ranger recon team and the Mojave Express. So it's just like physical goodies for like super fans, which is fine. I'm not saying don't do that, but it's just the way that they are introducing it. It's kind of interesting. And it does come with the Ultimate Edition of Fallout New Vegas on PC. It's also $155. So it's quite a lot.
As only for super fans, it seems like hey, if you really love New Vegas, sure, if you want to like just, you know, put it on your shelf, but
Yeah, I do really love New Vegas, but I have no need for a little Victor statue, as cool as that is.
Yeah, are you $155 love with a non-working PC physical version and just, you know, more goodies, I guess?
Mm-hmm. And the code, it's like you get a throwback style display box, like an old school PC box, but also the game codes for PC will be emailed, you know, in June. Like if even if you order this now, you get your game code in June. It's
that's so weird. Okay, I didn't even know about that. And there's no physical CD then. It's just game.
Nope.
No.
I mean, it's one of those things where none of those things are individually deal breakers, but like the sales pitch is not landing for me. But it's if you already like, I mean, I've got Fallout stuff, like I've got Fallout fan art on my home office. Like I am a big fan of this, and I'm still kind of like, eh, not for me. But if it's for you, it's a cool little set, and it's celebrating, you know, 15th anniversary release of their game. So can see it either way.
I feel like they could have, since the game is on GOG, they could have actually put a disc where you have the full game playable, like, you know, installable from the disc and all. I don't know why they didn't do that, because when they did the Skyrim, I don't know if you've seen that Skyrim anniversary box, not the Skyrim, sorry, the Elder Scrolls anthology box, which has like all the old games on discs, including like Skyrim and all, including Skyrim Special Edition. So when they did that, they had maps for all of them and everything, but for Fallout, I think they just included codes when they did that Nuke Box Collector's Edition. Like, I'll post pictures of these in the voice chat right now, but I think they're just moving away from that, and it's kind of weird because these games are on GOG, so it's not like you cannot do a disc version of it. So, yeah, it's just weird.
It would cost more money, and why would they do that when they can save on that?
That covers the Switch 2 news and all of the Fallout-related news. In some other announcements this week, probably the next major headline is an announcement of a new single-player open-world action RPG project. This is from the Korean studio Mad Engine. They've announced Project Tal, T-A-L. They've introduced this announcement with a 2-minute gameplay trailer, or at least gameplay-styled trailer. Some details and a press release, a bunch of screenshots, and slated to release for PCs and consoles in 2027. I kind of dislike when people say it looks like this crossed with this or whatever, but in order to describe it, you know, in a podcast, to me it looks like a colorful Neo, like Neo 2. It has a lot of focus on like what to me look like yokai, but this is obviously like Korean mythology, so I don't know like what the analog is. But that's how I kind of see this. And it has like the kind of the stamina-based Souls-like gameplay, but it also has like climbing mechanics like Dragon's Dogma, like described and shown briefly in the trailer. So I'm like, oh, that's kind of neat. So I was looking into this game a little bit just so like before this podcast, like I want to be able to speak to this a little bit. Like I don't know the developer that well, Mad Engine, or the publisher, WeMax. So I saw one thing that was concerning, and then one thing that was a little bit more promising is that I guess the current project from this developer is a game called Night Crows, which is a Web3 Bitcoin pay-to-earn, poorly received, like, gacha game. And I'm like, oh, that's not a good sign. But then they've said that this game is not planned to have any Web3 elements to it, like no blockchain, no pay-to-earn sort of stuff tied to it. I don't know about gacha. I saw this on, I think it was a PC Games End article, but just because their existing project Night Crows apparently was very poorly received for a lot of those reasons, this game they're trying to at least distance them from that framework. They're saying that this is a traditional action RPG project. So jury's still out, and seeing like once we know more to what extent that is or completely is avoided in terms of this game's, you know, financing. Sure.
Yeah. That's fair. So, you know, hope for the best for them, and hopefully, you know, this Project Tal is completely devoid of that when it finally releases in the far future.
Yeah, 2027. It looks fun, but also it's kind of one of those things where it's like, I need to see more. It's a little bit further out, but cool to see another studio taking their, you know, being able to incorporate the mythology of their countries and representing them in games like this.
For sure.
Here's another one that we had covered in the past, but that I had kind of forgotten, never got a localization announcement. This year in Japan, we got the release of an Idea Factory Compile Heart game, which we didn't have an official localized translation, so we were calling it, let me see here, Magic Librarian Ariana. So it released in August in Japan. We just got the announcement of the global release slated for next year for PlayStation 4 and 5 and Nintendo Switch. It'll be called Ariana and the Elder Codex, and it'll launch both physically and digitally on all those consoles and feature dual audio support. So just cool to see a global release slated for that game.
Yeah, this is a neat looking game whenever I saw it at throughout the Famitsu issues. But of course, like with all things under that umbrella, it's always a staggered release, the PC version. So, You know, neat, but I can hold out for a PC version, just like how what's happening with Mado Monogatari.
Also, one of the big upcoming November releases is Inazuma 11, Victory Road. I think, Josh, you're the most equipped to talk about what the new news this week is. I remember something about, like, a Pokemon bank for Inazuma 11. I saw that, how it was described. I don't know if that's what we're talking about here, or if it's more detailed.
It's part of it, yeah. So they had as I said last week, they had a live stream called Inadai, which was, you know, kind of the final live pre-release live stream for this game, I believe. And they might have a celebration one. Where they're going to go over some new details of this, you know, much anticipated project that has been almost a decade long in the making. But yeah, so out of that, you know, we had our level 5 CEO, Akihiro Hino, doing crazed explanations about, like, hey, kind of going over details like, you know, this game will have fucking everyone from Inazuma 11 history basically in this game in some way, shape, or form. So part of the announcements of this, I guess we'll lead off with what you were saying, Brian, was they're making a player bank for this game where you obtain a lot of these characters of, like, for the past entries in this chronicle mode, and they're going to have some, you know, gacha system that you can only roll for through in-game currency. There's no microtransactions and all with real life money and all that stuff with this gacha mechanic, where as you play the game, you'll receive currency and then you have a chance to basically roll for characters in pools from their entry that they came from. And as you collect these characters, obviously, since this game will have now over 5,400 characters in the game, with some of them being added, you know, in the subsequent weeks up to months, you know, so they won't all be there out day one, but, you know, they'll be added over time. But there's still, like, you know, thousands of characters on release. And as you're collecting them and as you start building up hundreds of them in your roster, you can transfer them to this, like, player bank in the game. And they even were straight up like, we don't know how long it'll take for people to get these characters. And, you know, we don't expect every single player to, like, get all the characters that we have in this game. So they're already talking about, like, you know, in the event that we were to make a sequel to this game, not to say that they are, like, hard confirming a sequel right away, but potentially, if we were to make a sequel to this game, we want players to be able to take who they collected in this game forward in that hypothetical sequel. So we're building the Pokemon Bank equivalent to this game right now. And I'm like...
No. That makes perfect sense, because it's like, even if they don't intend to make a new one right this instant, they made all these assets. It would be kind of stupid just to throw them away.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I applaud them, but also it's just like, it's insanity to talk about this right now, even before this game is out. I'm like, okay, level 5, if you say so. So, you know, they're making a Pokemon Bank equivalent in Inazuma 11, starting with this game. They also announced and released, they also built a whole search engine for this game called Inigle, and it's like an official search system for the players in this game. So if you're looking for a certain player, and if you're wondering if they're in this game, it's all up on a separate site, even in English, for like when you search just like a blanket, like, hey, I want you to list every character in this game, it's like it totals out to like 5,407, and a good chunk of those characters are still secrets because they're gonna be added like later, you know, patches down the line. But people already somewhat data mine who they are, because there is some weird oversight of like if you're trying to like search for them through like some localized or unlocalized name, the Japanese site, like I guess some of like the safeguards to like, you know, reveal them where there was like a gap in them. So people basically found that like, hey, they're a good, like a lot of the characters from like Inazuma 11 Ares and Orion, like almost all of them, like they're gonna be there, they're just under secrets. And then like part of them, part of this like player search functionality is like you can see like 360 3D character renders of them, so you can like go into their character page and look at their like in-game model aspect and spin them around and just seeing like how they're rendered in the game, like for each of these characters, thousands of characters. It's just like, okay, that's fucking insane that you're doing that, but that's cool. And also they've already made like revisions to some of the characters, like, oh, they're like, oh, like the when we launched this site, it was based on some of the old versions of the game. So some of the characters had like their models weren't updated, so they updated them like, you know, well, within like hours to a day of this site releasing to better reflect like what they look like now. So a lot of the characters look a lot better than they initially did when that site released. They also made like changes to like some of like the localized names, like for some of the like one of the characters, like this franchise is apparently full of like localized names versus like the original Japanese names. Like I forgot exactly what the unlocalized like original Japanese name of like the main character of the first game was, but I guess his name's like Mark Evans globally, you know, and that's he had a much more Japanese name like in the original release of that game. This game is this whole series is full of them, but one of them was like in when Inigo released, one of them had got an updated localized name to like Afro Diddy or Deity or whatever, to obviously better represents like the it's supposed to be a pun over Aphrodite, like the deity. But people are like, but we know him as Byron Love, like, you know, why would you change that? We like the name Byron Love. So they're like, okay, actually you're right, we're gonna change it back to Byron Love, and that'll be reflected in the game day one. I'm like, but his like soccer like nickname will still be like Aphrodite or something. I'm like, okay, you guys are still making, you know, changes and, you know, refinements to it. And also like they also allow you to view a good chunk of like the special Hisatsu moves in the game, like even the like WebM clips of showing like their specific animations. So when you go search them up, there's like over 700 of them, though a good chunk of them are like obviously secrets and whatnot.
I think the funniest thing is when I did my TGS demo. Again, I know nothing about Inazuma 11. I don't know any of that shit. I saw like a move where three of these like middle school / high schoolers, I don't know how old they are, like start levitating in midair as like in a triangle formation, then all hit the ball like with a drop kick at the same time. And I was like, dude, this rules.
Yeah, that's just how they play soccer over in Japan, apparently. So that's just Japanese soccer in middle school. But yeah, it's like I said, these two features alone are like pretty insane. They also explained that like, hey, they kind of did away with like at the very when they first announced Victory Road specifically for the Switch 1 version, they said you can dynamically switch between portrait and landscape view on the Switch 1 version. But then they decided like, you know, we're no longer gonna support that feature for the fairness of competition, because they felt like being able to have that feature on one platform and not other platforms would sway the balance of the game, because there's how online PvP if people wanted to do that. So instead, they're going to support like mouse controls on Switch 2 and PC as like a trade-off of that. Of like, if you controlling the game via like the mouse, you can actually like draw out like the movements of like what characters should, what what direction you want them to go. You can use the mouse controls on Switch 2 and PC for that. And I think over time, they're going to patch that functionality into the Switch 1 and PlayStation 4 version. I assume they're also going to come to the Xbox version in some way, shape, or form, though it was never explicitly mentioned in the broadcast. They only acknowledge the other platforms except Xbox on that. But they did acknowledge Xbox along with the other platforms on the system specs. Mikhail, you wanna take this one for the system specs on the Inazuma 11?
Yeah, before that, I've completely forgot about the portrait orientation thing, and I was wondering, do you think this is a side effect of them basically, like, I think soft canceling the mobile version, because this was originally supposed to be iOS, Android, PS4, and Switch, right? Like many years ago, and then they just stopped mentioning it.
They officially, I think they canceled that several months ago. Like, they acknowledged they canceled it. But yeah, this is definitely like, yeah, they're no longer making a mobile version of this game. I think that has that.
So I think like not having mobile means no portrait orientation, because you have a lot of games when they release them, especially for Japan, that you have portrait orientation. Like the Dragon Quest mobile ports are literally only playable in portrait mode, as an example. So yeah, I'm not surprised to see that happen. I completely forgot about that being in the thing. And for the system spec, yeah, I'm so, like, before discussing the actual specs which they've revealed, whenever a developer reveals what these specs are, it should always be treated as a target and not the actual thing until people have played them, because Bandai Namco is like, they're like, whatever, I don't know what to say, but every time they put up their spec for games, it's never 100% a representation of what the final build is. So with Inazuma 11 Victory Road, they say that the just the Switch 1 version is 30 fps, all the others are at least 60 fps or more. And what I found interesting is the PS5 version is 4k 60, but the Xbox Series X version is 4k 120, which is kind of interesting. The PlayStation 5 Pro version is also 4K 120, and PC can do above 120. But the Switch 2 version is 4K 60 as well, like the PS5 version. So this is going to be interesting to see how it plays out, though. And because, yeah, James played it on Switch 2, right?
Yeah, I can tell you right now, it's not native 4K. It's using some sort of upscaling. It looks good. It's not like a super low resolution where it's immediately like obvious. It's like, it's just something that I could tell. It's like, okay, you're using some sort of temporal like upscaling. It looks good. It's a high enough resolution. Most people, you're not going to give a shit, but just worth noting, I'm like 99% sure that is not native 4K.
Yeah. So this is why I said these are likely the target specs. We'll see how the full game ends up. I'm not sure what platforms I will be playing this on or whatever. Like, review will probably be on PC, but yeah, like, nothing confirmed yet. In an ideal world, I would definitely want to play this on PC and Switch too, to see how they both end up being, but we'll see how that plays out. I'm interested that they actually put this out early, because they didn't do this for Fantasy Life I, and yeah, we'll see how this goes. But I have one question for you, Josh. You brought up the, you know, the character stuff and all. Didn't they have some like platform specific deluxe edition bonus which gets you like a higher rate on some characters depending on what platform?
I think they did away with that. It's all universal now. They're like they got feedback, and they're like, yeah, they backtracked on that pretty quick. That's good. They also mentioned that for people who do want to stick with like the Japanese names, like the non-localized names, they do offer like a toggle in the game, like when you're going through like story mode, for example, and they refer to characters and you're playing it like in maybe Japanese voices. Like, they do have a toggle that's like, hey, in the subtitles, make sure it reflects their Japanese names, not their localized global names, which is, hey, much appreciated on that front as well. So there's no disconnect. But yeah, it's just, hey, the good news is it's not getting any more delays. I don't know what the bad news is yet. I have yet to play the game to see if, you know, where I land on it, but I'm just like, it is one of the projects that like, it continually blows my mind, like how much effort they're kind of putting into it, even up to like the last minute. It feels like they're still like addressing like players' concerns and like feedback on like newly deployed features, like Inigo, for example.
I'm wondering, I am genuinely curious, which will take longer to 100%, this game or the 100 line?
Oh, man.
Probably the this game.
I think it is this game. They released not one, not two, but three final trailers simultaneously in this game.
I'm genuinely interested to get into this, but there's too many other RPGs I need to fucking play. It's like
I don't know how I'm going to lock in for this game, but I'm determined to lock in. I just don't know how I'm going to have the time to lock in, but I have to.
I don't know how I'm going to have to lock. It's like out of like nowhere, the last like 2 months of this year is making like our Game of the Year podcast going to be a fucking nightmare.
It's not that crowded. I mean, November 13th, Inazuma 11. November 13th, Yakuza Kiwami Switch 2. November 13th, Yakuza Kiwami Switch. Yakuza Kiwami 1 on Switch 2. Monster Rise Hunter Stories 1 and 2 on Xbox. Where Winds Meet, Solo Leveling, Arise, Demon School, if it actually releases. And Moonlighter. That's like just 1 week. No big deal.
Not to mention the Rise Trilogy Deluxe or Director's
yep,
Cut.
Yep. Also
all
there.
Three of those, each of them having like additional content, no save transfer, so you have to replay all of those 30 plus hour games from the beginning.
Yeah, it's let's see, I'm looking at November. Yeah, I don't know. Good luck.
Dragon Quest 1 plus 2 next very week
soon. Yeah,
I still need to play Digimon. I think I said this on this podcast, but I was planning to play Digimon before Pokemon because it's like they won't send us code early. Little did I know.
I saw the completion. I saw Brian got the achievement of beating Digimon. Congratulations!
He did it. No, I liked it. I liked it a lot, and I was kind of looking at like all the other like. Okay, I never watched the 2020 like reboot anime or the new Beat Break anime. And speaking of characters that like get renamed, I was thinking like, oh, it's like Serena versus Usagi or Matt versus Yamato from the original like Digimon.
That's right. Yes. Yes.
I wish Granblue had that feature where I could turn off fucking localized names because I hate those freaking internal names being localized.
Obviously, we don't have the time to get into it, but I'm genuinely curious. Who was like your goat Digimon, Brian, in your playthrough? Like, one that you loved.
So I say didn't really Greymon, do any please. Planning. I didn't do any planning in terms of like, oh, if I get this, and then I'll be able, like, I didn't DNA Digivolve anything because I never had the right Digimon with the right personalities or whatever. But I ended up with the battle mode Shrine Greymon, which is like Plus. Uh-huh. And I also had like one of the mega versions of Vidramon. It's called like
Whole Force Vidramon or something.
Ultra Force Vidramon. And then, Vikemon or Vikingmon.
Oh, like
Zukomon, only he has got like the Viking like wolf pelt
nice
howl, whatever you call it.
Awesome.
But fun game. Oop. Yeah. And now nice. That game's done and I'm on to like other October releases.
The next game you're planning to get the platinum or 100% achievement.
Out of all the things listed and slated, like Dragon Quest, I wanna put a big focus on that for the remake. But back in the news, there's not a ton left here. We did get some news about the another game we haven't talked about, the upcoming Tales of Xilla remaster, which is like in a week, right? That's also October, right?
Yeah, I believe so.
And yes. Adam or Josh, correct me if I'm wrong. We had believed, but didn't quite have confirmation that they were working on a Xilla 2 remaster. Was this week the first time that they said like, yeah, we're working on it, like? Confirmed.
Actually, we basically just assumed before it was announced that, like, okay, if they do Xilla, how do you pronounce it? It should be a dual pack, right? It's not. And it's like, okay, if they're doing one, they're going to do two eventually, right? Like, they have to. They're not just going to do one. So it felt like it was inevitable. There were no hints at it yet, but other than, like, you know, if they're doing one, they're going to do two. So they basically just said, yeah, we're doing two. More information later. And then the more interesting note is that they said there's yet another remaster in the works also in addition to Xilla 2. So kind of going down the list of what that could possibly be. So with Tales of Xilla and Xilla 2, that basically accounts for the HD era, like the PS3 era of Tales games. So then it's like, okay, I guess we got to go back the next generation to like the PlayStation 2 GameCube era. It's like, well, we already got Symphonia. So what does that leave for like remaster potential? Abyss and Legendia, really?
Well, no, they did say that they're not ruling out handheld games or games that haven't been localized.
Well, that's
so
true.
It's possible.
But I'm going for like slope of least resistance here, path of least resistance. I'm thinking PS2 game that is localized. I'm not saying it has to be that, but I'm thinking what is most likely, it's going to be a game that's already localized. That's not, I'm thinking path of least resistance, it's Abyss.
I'm thinking path of least resistance, probably using the engine that they've specifically worked on so far, like Graces F, which is the PS3 engine. I gotta assume that the Vita games are using a branch of that same engine. So if the main obstacle in remastering this stuff is like the code base, if that's already done, then those two games might be like on the docket. But none of us know. None of us know. It's just speculation.
This came off of like a new Famitsu interview with producer Yusuke Tomizawa. As you mentioned, Tales of Xillia 2 remaster is officially confirmed. They're working on it. They have no timetable right now when that's going to be released, but they are working on the Tales of Xillia 2 remaster, which is cool. Tales of Xillia 2 is a fun game, especially when you play as the main character. It's awesome. Then, as you mentioned, they also said, hey, they're also working on another Tales of remaster, if you don't know yet. I think it's Abyss, personally, but it would be cool if it was like stuff like Tales of Rebirth, but that would take, you know, a lot of time and effort, because that never got an official English release, or, you know, at least outside of Japan, really.
Although Bandai Namco has, they did remaster, Freedom Wars, which that was Vita, right?
Yes.
Yes.
So, like, it'll be Tales of Hearts R. I don't know.
Tales of Hearts R, and finally give it that dub that it was originally supposed to have that they cut last minute.
We'll see. And as for a brand new Tales entry, they're like, you know, it's very non-committal. It's like, you know, we're always thinking about it. We have nothing more to say, you know, as we are working on other, you know, announcements at its time, but they have nothing more to say on that. Obviously, it's probably going to come in the future, and they just have nothing to say right now. So that is pretty much the news on the Tales of front. So it's good to see Xillia 2, probably next year. Obviously, you know, we don't have any new... We don't know anything more than you do, but probably next year.
I mean, I wasn't even expecting there to be two remasters than one year this year. Like, I know remasters are not, you know, they're smaller projects than brand new games, but like still two in one year.
We'll take nine months
apart or whatever.
And both of the titles, you know, they chose are pretty good. Like Graces F, you know, well regarded as one of the best, and Xillia, pretty solid entry as well.
Yes, I figure Xillia 2 will be like next spring if they're going to stay at this cadence.
And Xillia 2 was really big in Japan. Like Japan really loves Xillia 2. So
I think what I like about the second one is the gameplay, or mostly Luger. How you play Luger?
Yeah. I was talking with Adam about it. It is a cool game, but it's definitely the Tales game that you feel the severe gap of like fun between Luger and like the rest of the who's the main character versus the rest of the cast. Like the rest of the cast, they're fine to play, but when you're playing as him, you feel like a fucking god and you feel cool every time because of his expanded moveset.
It's like got carried by this one guy. That's all you play for.
He's awesome, man. Love him.
Just a couple trailers and then a bunch of dates to wrap this out. Both of these trailers are for upcoming Owlcat published titles. We've talked about both of these recently. Shadow of the Road, one of the games that you talked about, Josh, from the Steam's Next Fest. It got a new gameplay trailer during the Autumn 2025 Galaxies Showcase. It's just a little under a minute, just showing some of the character models and some of the tactical gameplay of that. And then Rue Valley, this is the Disco Elysium like time loop game that's releasing in November. They released a new trailer called Voices of Rue Valley character trailer. And it goes into a little bit of like sort of like some dialogue and like about some of like the personalities that you can meet in this game. But I also thought it would like actually like give voice actors like, oh, this is going to tell me who's voicing the characters, but they don't actually do that. It's just, this is a trailer for the characters and their voices, but not actually highlighting the voice actors, which I thought was interesting. But
that's odd. You would expect that to announce the voice actors and actresses with a trailer like.
Just the way they titled it, if they just said character trailer, I'd be like, that might or might not have voice actors, but they call it Voices of Rue Valley character trailer. I'm like, that it's just a character trailer. And both of these trailers are pretty short. So they just had the opportunity to platform their games on this autumn 2025 Galaxy event. One of them's coming out in literally just under like 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And then Shadow of the Road, I don't think we have a date for that, though obviously it did show up at the Steam Next Fest, so it's been playable. But doesn't have a full release date. Sales update. We haven't had a sales update in a while. This is a sales update that I don't think really surprises anyone. Pokemon Legends ZA has sold just under 6 million copies in its first week, 5.8. And I guess we don't have it in our news post, but I thought they did a breakdown of Switch 1 versus Switch 2, and it was like nearly half and half, if I remember right, which for the Switch 2 being less than half a year old, I thought was pretty impressive.
The thing about that is I saw a lot of sites reported differently, and because the announcement for the sales numbers was just in Japanese and Kite wasn't online, I didn't include that because I didn't want to go by a Google translation on this. So yeah, that's why.
That's the right, posture to take. Yeah.
Because I saw some say that it had sold approximately half. Some said it sold less than half. And I was like, I'm not risking this. So I just said, let me just report what I know for sure.
You could have pinged me and I could have checked.
Yeah.
But either way, you know, unsurprisingly, pretty strong start. Pretty good game.
Yep.
You know, it's going to sell a lot more. Who knows? Like, I'm kind of interested to see, like, will they have, like, holiday discounts for this game? I have to imagine.
I think they're pushing it with the bundle, right? Like how they did Mario Kart. Like there's a Pokemon bundle, and I don't know if they're doing this in the US where some Mario Kart bundles you had the code, and some of them it was like pre-license installed, and you could just.
Oh yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
So for this, I believe like a lot of my friends have been buying the console and selling the code because Pokemon you can sell for like full price digitally, right? So. They're getting a nice discount on the console by buying it with that. So there are like some regions with the code at least. So I know some people doing that.
As for some upcoming dates, Eruta, Eruta. This is like an action RPG baking sim hybrid. This is a early access. It's been in early access, I think, since mid-2024. It'll have its full release in early November.
We talked about this game like twice in the podcast. I haven't been checking up on it, but I heard they finally added the final weapon and you could play it during the Tokyo Game Show, but, you know, or something
like that. You weren't there, child. Why were you there? You need to be on the ground, hands-on reporting, a Ruto reporter.
Don't worry, I'll check out the full game. I beat like the second island, and then it's like, oh well, you gotta wait for more, and then it's.
Are you excited?
It's out in 2 weeks, basically.
Yeah,
I'm excited. I actually do like this game. It's like Dave the Diver when I gave Dave the Diver over the time, and I was like, oh yeah, these games share similar mechanics. You collect stuff, and you play this mini game to sell the food, really, right? So it's just kind of like the same idea, right?
That's your angle with the review that you write on this game. It's like it's just like Dave the Diver. You would get a lot of eyes. You said that. Like, are you sure?
What about the guy that you meet at the beginning in Dave the Diver? That Satoshi guy that looks like Ash Ketchum.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I'm interested in checking the game. I also got this as your birthday present.
I know, so I need to get around to it. I need to get around to it. Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
So yeah, definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, November is just filling up. The last Kingdom Come Deliverance 2 DLC, Mysteria Ecclesiae. It's an Eastern European word. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. It looks like it's another kind of like subterfuge mission involving like a monastery, which should remind a lot of people about the end game of the first Kingdom Come Deliverance, where you had to do a lot of stuff while staying hidden and, you know, undercover. And we knew that this game was getting 3 DLCs, so having this announced and dated for November 11th is not a surprise. But I did see that, like, in the trailer for this, they said the final adventure. And people are like, oh, is this where Henry's story ends? Because we don't know for sure. So, but yeah, this is the final three DLCs for Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. Obviously a well-received game that we'll probably be talking about a bunch during the Game of the Year podcast.
It's worth mentioning that it's, I feel like it's priced, if you want to get this sold this separately, not part of the expansion pass, this is going to be available on its own for $14 US dollars. Is this, it's relatively more expensive than the other ones, I have to imagine, because it's like a story expansion.
I got the triple pack or whatever, the expansion pass, so I wasn't sure.
Yeah, let me go check. Because the other ones, like, you know, the Lion's Crest, about $5, the Gallant Huntsman's Kit, that $3, but then when it comes to like the other ones, like Legacy of the Forge is $14 as well. Okay.
So that's coming out November 11th. Here's a game we've talked about a few times, Kingdom of the Dump. This is like the action RPG that takes place like in a landfill. It's coming out on November 18th for PC. And then what else I got? Oh, the last two dates are delays into 2026. I don't think either of these are a surprise. Elden Ring Tarnished Edition officially delayed to 2026 for polish. I think we all knew that was coming.
Yeah, I was like, there's no freaking way this. I'd be surprised if they allowed this to release this year in that state.
Releasing on December 31st.
Yeah, like we need the time. Yeah, this definitely needs this.
Imagine if Bandai Namco saw how well Digimon did. It's like, oh, thank God we can justify delaying this Elden Ring port.
No, they'll see the Persona 2. I mean, for the Persona 3, yeah, Persona 3 be like, yeah. Oh yeah, it's like they let that get away, so surely we could do it too, right?
Yeah, just sneak it. Man. Like, imagine if they snuck it along like right behind Persona 3. It's like, oh, we're just gonna. It's like a Trojan horse almost.
It's like, what was that? They said they'll fix it later. It's like, or it was want to make sure it released, but the
performance. Yeah, just let, you know, let Atlas get all the heat. It's okay, right? We're elders already.
And Celesta 2 was originally announced to release in early access in 2025. It's been playable in a few demo events, but it's pushing its early access release back to 2026 for its polish and
that. Quality improvements. Yeah, take your time.
Mm-hmm. I do know at least one person who swears that Celesta 1 is a better. Well, I guess maybe not that hot of a take, but it's a better interpretation of Dungeons & Dragons than Baldur's Gate 3.
Okay, I'm interested. Yeah.
But yeah, so both Celesta 2 and Elden Ring Tarnished Edition, put them on the 2026 calendar. And that's it. So next week, it'll be our first podcast in November, November 1st. It's a week away. Crazy to think about that. I know for a fact we'll be talking about Dragon Quest and a lot of other games that are released in the back half of October that we'll see how the stars align in terms of whether we have the cast and the capability to talk about them. But I know we'll talk about Dragon Quest next week. We have a lot of other games coming out in this window. I know we have a bunch of people that are going to be jumping into Outer Worlds 2. We have Zilla Remaster.
I'm having bad thoughts and thinking about trying Anime Warframe. That do at night Abyss game.
I'm interested in doing it. This whole gacha model is completely sold me.
The fact that they don't really have a one for characters and weapons, like there's no gacha banners for it. It's like you earn them. They give you a handful for free, like, and then if you want to like earn like new characters, like you can earn it like just by grinding pretty much. Like sort of like Warframe. But from what I understand, like you don't have to like wait real life time to build them. Like, you just, like, exchange that currency and you get that character. So, we'll see. Josh, I don't know. Maybe it's going to be awesome. Who knows?
Josh, you help me decide this. Do I spend this upcoming week playing Dragon Quest 3 HD 2D to finish it in time for Dragon Quest 1 2 HD 2D, or should I do Digimon?
I'm always going to go Digimon at this point. My vote is Digimon, and Brian can back me up on that.
Right, I'll just say Digimon, just because everyone here
right, Brian?
Played Dragon Quest.
I was trying to think of something like witty, like, but I couldn't go with anything witty. They're both good. Just play them both at the same time.
Okay, there you go. Simultaneously.
That,
yeah. You have multiple monitors. You have a beefy CPU or CPU.
He has multiple handhelds as well.
Yeah, just do why they play two games at once.
Have you seen that, like, the people who played Pokemon Go on their bikes and they would just like have multiple phones up? Like,
I have seen that only with all of you.
Only with all your different PC handhelds. One will be Digimon and one will be Dragon Quest. There you go.
Yeah, you have that crazy Iron Thor thing that Chao got with the dual screen.
I was using it to... Yeah, I was multitasking. I was playing Honkai Star Rail on the top and there's Street Fighter Strike on the bottom.
There you go. It's that easy.
Oh my god. Just like a fidget spinner of a like Android handheld, I swear to god.
We'll just put that as a podcast title. People won't know unless they listen to the very end what the hell we're talking about. But obviously, yeah, go give, since he's not here to champion himself, but go to inverse.com and check out Hayes's review of Outer Worlds 2. Check out Junior's review of Outer Worlds 2 on RPG site. Check out our Persona 3 Reload Switch 2 review on RPG site. Check out our Outer Worlds Obsidian interview on the site that Adam did. Check out RPG site on all social media networks. Search for RPG space site. You should be able to find us. If you enjoyed this podcast on whatever podcast service of choice, leave us a like, leave us a rating, leave us a comment. We'd like to see those. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPG site. Tune in next week. We're going to be talking about Duet Night Abyss and Dragon Quest, apparently. I don't know if we...
apparently.
So we'll see. And maybe a few other things, but we'll play it by ear. But until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care.